Before we start, I'm going to make a special request, because I can see now we're becoming very heavy one side. Can I request all members of parliament to actually be the side, and we can have the presenters, the department, the GEPF, to be that side. That does not mean any other thing, just members being one side, so that we're able to interact appropriately with the stakeholders that are with us here. As soon as we're settled, then we'll start with the program.
No floor crossing, please.
Members, stakeholders that are present here, I'll just briefly indicate to all of you who is there, and I'll also outline the proceedings for the day. Amongst us here, we do have institutions that are going to make a presentation. As you are aware, there are two committees that came together. I am Joyce Muloi Moropa, the Chair for Public Service and Administration. With the chairperson for the Portfolio Committee for Finance, Honorable Thaba Mofumad. So both of us will be taking through this process. And part of why we brought these committees together is because we are trying as Parliament as much as is possible to ensure that rather than calling one institution more than once to various committees, if there is a need, we collaborate around having that kind of So amongst us here, we've got the Government Employee Pension Fund, that is GEPF, which will be doing a presentation on the performance for the previous year. That will be followed by the brief overview that will be done by the Department of Public Service and Administration, but it won't be as outlined in the program. What the department will be doing will just be doing a lead for the government employees, for the government employees' medical aid scheme, because that presentation, the next presentation, will be on the government employee medical pension fund, medical scheme, on its performance for the previous year. So we've got two institutions that will be doing a presentation. That is GEPF, and it will be followed by GEMS. So both these institutions are the ones that we've actually invited as Parliament to get an overview on their performance for the previous year. When GEMS will be doing a presentation, it will be led by the department. All other issues that are indicated, like the CPSI, the PCTA, will be carried over to the next meeting by the department, but they won't be done at this point in time. So administratively, that is where we are. After this presentation, we are going to request the members, particularly for the Committee of Public Service and Administration, to remain so that we go through our administrative work as we always do. We'll be going through minutes, going through some reports, where necessarily we wouldn't want to keep everybody hostage for those matters. We'll release the rest of the stakeholders to be free. So at this point in time, we will be focusing then on the program. We will be focusing on two institutions that will be doing a presentation, and I'm going to hand over to Honorable Thaba to proceed with the facilitation of this meeting. Thanks.
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong if you said comrade. Okay. Thanks, Co-Chair, Honorable Muloi. I think you have already done the introduction and the processes that we are going to follow in terms of taking the presentations. As you have already outlined, that the first presentation that our committee, and my committee in particular, will be more interested and probably would see whether we'll be able to reinforce you moving forward in terms of other presentations. If you so wish, I think we'll also consider that from our side. the presentation that we are going to be looking at more seriously and closely is the one from the GEPF. Let me also say, probably start by welcoming the former Member of Parliament. I say former because I don't want to say ex. You know, exes have got different quotations and meanings. Former Member of Parliament, and now the chairperson of the Government Employee Pension Fund, Mr. Arthur Muloto. Welcome back to this chamber. I do know that in your previous life you did also do some work that I'm now tasked to handle here in Parliament. So you are not a new face at all. And probably you know how to manage politicians. I also want to indicate to honorable members that you are a relatively new board in the sense that you are less than a year old. I think you were inaugurated somewhere around September. And you are the second board of the Government Employee Pension Fund. The first one was chaired by Martin Kaskas. Prior to that, the sole shareholder or trustee on behalf of government and the employees of government was the minister. You have a very, very important task before you and would want to really welcome all of you, your chairperson, your deputy chairperson, the acting principal officer. We are in your hands. You'll take us through the presentation and we'll interact with that presentation afterwards. Hopefully we'll be in a better position to can understand what you do, what are the challenges that confront you on a daily basis, and also ordinary people and ordinary members of the fund itself, and how you intend to address those issues. And amongst other issues, of course, is how you, in the meantime, from time to time, invest and look after this very important fund of our country in relation to the developmental needs of our people. Over to you, Mr. Muloto.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, indeed it's a great honor and privilege to be interacting with you on the activities of the GEPF, one of the largest funds in Africa and the sixth largest in the world. It's a daunting task because this fund is massive. It's a third of the GDP of this country, and every company that you see on the stock exchange, we own almost, on average, 10% of it. So it's quite a challenge. Chairperson, the presentation will be structured as follows. Ms. Adrifa Nikerk will give a brief overview of the fund, while Mr. Gier will cover the annual report and all the operational issues. However, in addition, we feel that the following issues, as highlighted in the annual report and our presentation, are important to highlight to the committee. One, the impact of the recent economic crisis on our fund, the challenges in relation to service improvement and the initiatives we have put in place to address the matter. On this issue, we really need the cooperation of employer departments to ensure that we reduce the backlogs because the employer departments are responsible for keeping the data and ensuring that exit documentation is submitted timely to our institution. Secondly, we want to talk about our responsible investing activities. The GPF is one of the founding signatories of the United Nations Principles of Responsible Investment, and we have recently launched this policy in Soweto in March. Basically, what we are saying through this policy is that environmental issues, social and governance, corporate governance issues should be guiding our decision, investment decision-making processes. Chairperson, let me just briefly dwell before I hand over to my colleagues to deal with the presentation on a matter that has been quite topical and which received some publicity. It's around the Easy Buyer Fund. The GPF took a decision, given our history, our painful history, to contribute to social upliftment of this country by dedicating 5% of our investment capital to social responsible investment opportunities. In this regard, we have realized certain returns, but our impact on other areas has not been that great. The fund has, through the PIC, in the past, focused narrowly on BEE activities, and the board has taken a decision to come up with a new policy called the Developmental Investment Framework to broaden our scope of operation and activities of the Easy Buyer Fund. Hence, we have decided to review the strategy to further diversify this portfolio. In this regard, we have pursued research over the last 2 years in which we consulted stakeholders, internal and external, reviewed the landscape, and internal best practices on responsible investment were sought. Our research has led us to focus on 4 pillars of this new strategy. One is to invest in economic infrastructure. 2 is to invest in social infrastructure. The third pillar is to invest in the greener economy. The fourth one is to invest in enterprise development, broad-based black economic empowerment, and job creation. Chairperson, allow me, as I'm running off my introductory remarks, to come to a matter that has been reported in the press, the AfriSam deal. This board, like you have indicated, Chairperson, is a new board, and we have looked at the issue and taken various decisions on the matter. We have put limits in respect of investments that can be made through the Easy Buyer Fund for the future. And now going forward, will be limited to a maximum of 5% over the overall Easy Buyer allocation. And in instances where there are opportunities that the PIC might discover that would require more than 5% of our investment capital in Easy Buyer, they would have to approach the board to get approval. Secondly, the board has decided that the investment subcommittee of the board should investigate the governance structures that are necessary to ensure that we maximize returns for our members and pensioners. Thirdly, we have asked the PIC to provide us with a full report regarding the investment and the strategy they will employ to turn around the investment. This report will inform any necessary steps that will be taken by the board in the future. Given that we are a new board, we have called on the PIC to give full account on the Easy Buyer portfolio so we could understand the opportunities we are invested in and the risks. We will be having a workshop in this regard on the 19th of May. Chairperson, I would therefore, at this point, want to hand over to our acting principal officer to give us a review of the fund and proceed to Mr. Chie. I would appeal to members not to be intimidated by the voluminous report. We'll be going through it speedily.
Thank you, Arthur. I'll be very brief in my introduction to allow Mr. Chie to focus more on our achievements. As you all know, the GEP was established in terms of the GEP law on the 1st of May 1996. Its predecessor was the Government Service Pension Fund, the GSCF, and the GEP was born out of the amalgamation of the GSCF, TBCC pension schemes, and other pension schemes from the self-governing state. Okay, thanks. Is that better?
I'll start from the beginning.
Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. The GEPF was established on the 1st of May, 1996, in terms of the Government Employees Pension Law. Its predecessor was the Government Service Pension Fund, the GSPF, and the GEPF was born out of the amalgamation of the GSPF, TBCC pension schemes, and other pension schemes from self-governing states. The GEPF is a defined benefit fund. Currently, the members contribute 7.5% of their salary into the GEPF, The employers, the state, contributes 13% for civil service and 16% for uniformed services. The state is a major sponsoring employer in terms of Section 31 of the GEP law, and the fund is a juristic entity governed by a juristic board of trustees consisting of 16 members. 8 of these members are nominated by the employer, and 8 of the members are nominated by the employees. This is the main responsibilities of the Board of Trustees. The Board is mainly responsible for the effective and efficient administration of the fund. It's also responsible for financial reporting and audit arrangements and to communicate with its members and pensioners regarding the fund and other retirement issues. One of the main responsibilities of the Board is to protect the members' rights as well as to invest the assets of the fund. It's also responsible to do annual pension increases, to review the contribution rates, and to do a statutory validation of the fund every 3 years. Section 33 of the GEP law also allows for the board to dissolve the fund in specific circumstances. As our chairperson, Mr. Molotta, has indicated, we are currently the largest fund in Africa in terms of our assets and membership under administration, and also the 6th largest fund in the world. This is according to the Watson Wyatt Pension Fund survey. Currently, we've got close to 1.2 million contributing members, 318,000 pensioners and beneficiaries, and as of 31st March 2009, we had 640 billion of assets under management. Currently, as of 31st March 2010, we've got close to 819 billion of asset under management. I do need to caution the honourable members and honourable chairpersons that these are unaudited figures, the 31st March 2010 figures. Thank you. I will now hand over to Mr. Chia to take us through the rest of the presentation.
Chairperson, let me start by saying the GPF has obtained an unqualified audit opinion for the year ended March 2009. Since we fall under the government employee pension law, we have sought refuge under the regulatory reporting requirements in terms of the Financial Services Board. That's what we are intending to fall under in the future. In terms of the financial highlights, Chair, as at March 2009, the accumulated investment and reserves amounted to 640 billion. You will see that the figure fell down from the March figure of 707. As a result of the economic meltdown experienced by almost the whole world. Contribution received amounted to 30 million, and that coincidentally equals the benefits that we paid to the exiting members. The return on investment, what we have shared at the end of March, 2009, we had 622 billion. As already explained, we fell down from that figure due to the financial crisis by 99 billion. Also, it's a lot of reduction. So the next slide is just to say, Chair, in the financial year 2006, the performance of the fund was very good. Generally, I think the economy was performing well. We really swung very up, but subsequently, we've been realizing returns on a declining rate, because 2006 financial year was really an abnormal year in terms of the economic performance or market performance. I've already, in terms of the return of on investment, I've already indicated that there. We lost 99 billion rents, mainly attributed to the global financial crisis, and the 2.5 billion in respect of the impairment of our assets, mainly the AfriSam that the chairperson has already mentioned. In terms of our achievements further, Chair, just to say GPF has now designed what we call an asset liability model, which intention is to match liabilities to investment to determine the gap, because it's very helpful from time to time to look at the health of the fund, because this is a defined benefit scheme. If the fund is lowly funded, then the government as the guarantor or underwriter of the scheme will have to come in. And fortunately, since the inception of the GPF, government has never put additional money into the fund, except in between 1997 and 2000, where employees were required to put additional 7% of their savings check into what we call the stabilization fund, just to make sure that the fund position, funding position moves up. So that's basically the asset liability model which GPF is utilizing as a basis for its actuarial valuation. Chair, just to say, in terms of the law, we do actuarial valuation every 3 years. The last actuarial valuation, that's official valuation, was done in 2008, March 2008. And at that time, we had a 100% funding level. We have just indicated on the right that due to the financial crisis, that funding level decreased. And that's eaten into our solvency reserves and our pension increase reserve. But the bottom line is, at 2008, the financial health of the fund was very good, 100%. This is what I think the chairperson wants to know, how our assets are invested through PIC. We don't physically go and invest. We use the PIC as our investor. We screen them in an investment mandate, and this is the strategic asset allocation. The range which were given to PIC to invest into the different classes of assets is as the table there. Equities is in the range of 50 to 55%. Private equity, the range is 3 to 9. Bonds, 25 to 45. Property, not to 7%, cash instrument 10%, and structured investment not to 3%. I think the private equity there is the buyer, just to clarify that, it's the buyer. And as the chairperson has indicated, more work is now being done on how to effectively utilize the Isbaya Fund.
Yeah. Just a quick one for the chairperson. The Pan-African Infrastructure Development Fund is a fund that was initially developed by, the idea was developed by the PIC, and the GPF has invested $215 million. There are other funders like APSA, African Development Bank. The main aim of this fund is to contribute towards the building of infrastructure in other African countries. So that's our contribution to Africa.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe as we move on, you have just given the investment by the PIC into the African Fund. The rest of the continent, do you have an idea? in terms of the contribution into the fund itself?
Well, our contribution as a GMPF is limited to the $250 million.
And why do you dollarize the contribution?
Well, I'd have to hand over to my head of investment to give the background on why it was dollarized.
Okay, we just want to understand it in simple terms, rent. Thanks.
Should I add to that? Yeah, Chairperson, honorable members, just to give maybe a brief background on the Pan-African Infrastructure Development Fund and as to why it's a dollarized fund. The idea was that we had to have other investors outside South Africa investing in the fund, like the African Development Bank and other institutions in the African continent have invested. So the idea was to have the fund not only accessible to South African investors, but also available to other institutions outside the African continent. That was the idea. And the purpose of the fund is to invest in infrastructure projects throughout the continent. For example, we've got investments of a cable running from Portugal to land to Nigeria, the main one cable, that will connect the African continent to the rest of the world from a digital perspective. We've got investment in oil rigs in Nigeria. We own certain investments in Kenya in telecommunications. It's a very good fund which really we believe will empower our people, but will also generate excellent returns for the fund. And then in relation to the EC buyer, I think I will have to hand that back to the chairman because a few next slides talk to the developmental framework that he highlighted in his introductory remarks.
Chairperson, I think what we need to emphasize here, there's a notion that we are like a charity organization throwing members' money and pensioners' money at a social project, and that's not the issue. We are saying that we are identifying investment opportunities that will generate excellent investment return with a high positive social impact. Like I've indicated, we have done quite a good research on this, and there are four pillars to this strategy. The investment in economic infrastructure will be looking at energy infrastructure, transport infrastructure, water infrastructure, broadband infrastructure. And incidentally, I had an engagement with people who are involved in this area, and they've been realizing very good returns, even more than equities, some at a region of 20%. So it's not that we are doing something that's not of benefit to our members. So it's investment in social infrastructure, affordable housing, healthcare, education. And we have also done a bit of research. We've realized that there are some of our members who are not who are underserviced by the traditional financial institutions. They are not that poor to secure an RDP house, but they are not that well off to secure a bond from a bank. So it's an area that we are looking at, so that we should give something back to our members, so that we can explore other avenues of advancing housing loans to our members. The pillar three is investment in sustainability projects, renewable energy, green buildings, clean technologies. And pillar four is investment in new enterprises, BEE, and job creation. Chairperson, I've indicated about our policy on responsible investment. We are the founding signatories of the United Nations Backed Principles of Responsible Investment. And as signatories, we have certain commitments that we have agreed to. One is to incorporate environmental, social, and governance issues in investment analysis and decision-making. I need to simplify these issues. For us, we are concerned about the sustainability of this company. On governance issues, one would have to use a practical example. If, for instance, we invest in a company and this company is being fined huge amounts of money for price fixing, obviously it's hurting the bottom line and the share price. So it has a direct impact on the value of our assets. So we have to be concerned about those issues. The same with issues of environment and social. Because, like I've indicated, we have got a painful history, and it's important that we should contribute to our social stability. The issues of climate change are known to these members and their implications. Chairperson, I just want to rush through this because it's quite a lengthy a presentation. We are saying on SDPF that sound environmental management forms an essential part of sustainable economic growth and social development, which is the basic ingredients for corporate social sustainability. The mismatch between social and private returns is not sustainable. The two need to be aligned if the market system is to be sustainable. And hence, governance mitigates risk of total corporate failure, which ultimately leads to enhanced long-term returns. The message that we want to send out there is that we have to generate profits that are worth having. We can't just pursue, go for an exclusive pursuit of profits at the expense of the environment, at the expense of society, at the expense of good corporate governance. We're saying citizenship beyond legal duties. We endorse and implement sector charters, transformation beyond minimum required, adopt high environmental standards, uphold high levels of ethical and governance standards. And we want to encourage companies to obey the law, to adhere to regulations, offer healthy working places, be profitable and create value. Pay people fairly, treat stakeholders fairly, don't waste capital, do not cause collateral damage. I'll then hand over to Mr. Gier to talk about this slide. This is a very important slide, and I would request Mr. Gier to dwell a bit on this, because some of the threats that we have received as GPF, it's due to lack of the appreciation of the challenges that we face, and I'm glad that we are interacting with the Portfolio Committee of Public Service and Administration, because some of the challenges are because of poor coordination between GPF and the department, because departments have to appreciate that the issue of exit documentation and the keeping of correct member data is crucial. We are dependent on that. If we don't get that correct data, for us, it will always be that there will be a perception that we are not being responsive and we are not paying out benefits timely, because correct data is quite crucial. I would request Mr. Gier to speak more in detail about the slide and also to address the issue that was covered in the Sunday Times about one principle. Over to you, Mr. Gier.
Yeah, I think to do the slides good, let me just start with the negative publicity that we have received. I think in the past 2 months, there were two high-profile cases that appeared in the media. The first one is the last one, which appeared in the last 2 Sundays ago on a teacher who allegedly didn't receive his retirement benefits in KwaZulu-Natal. In fact, it is true. The teacher retired officially, but when the department for which he worked submitted the exit benefit, we discovered that he was exited due to ill health, disability pension in 1997. Then we started taking the matter up to try to find out why is he now only exiting now when the department exited him in 1997. Further investigation did reveal that whoever exited the teacher continued to receive annuity for a year, and when DPF in 1998 demanded the life certificate, it couldn't be produced. So we stopped, EPF then stopped payment. The matter only surfaced when the teacher wanted to retire recently. What we have done when we discovered this matter, our forensic team went to KwaZulu-Natal to talk to the Department of Education, the provincial treasury, because they were already investigating the case, and the affected member as well. And we discovered that indeed he was fraudulently exited. We have subsequently corrected the matter on our side by making sure that we exit the teacher through granting a proper benefit. The information that I got this morning is that all work has been now processed. We are only waiting for SARS directive because all the exit documents are referred to SARS for tax directive. If his tax affairs are in order, he will receive his payment this Thursday. The money will be in the bank. Okay, thank you. Yeah, now on the administration part of the benefits payment, we have three very important role players, Chair. We've got ourselves as GPF, we've got employer departments, then we've got SARS. We 100% dependent on employers to provide us with correct information at exit and timeously. The problem that we have been experiencing is that employers do sometimes send this information very late. Sometimes they send it on time, but the information is not correct because they don't update the records of employees. You would recall that at 19 when I joined government, I was Miss So-and-so. At 25 when I got married, I changed. When I got children, I must change. But that gap is the biggest challenge that we have from employers. Just to indicate that we have been working with employers actively, educating them on their part of the responsibility. We are at the verge of signing a service level agreement with the employer, but we are going to engage DPSA first because we see DPSA as the main employer to guide us in respect. But in terms of now dealing with the backlogs, when the previous board, I think, took over, there was a huge number of backlogs which they started fighting down. The slide here just indicates the extent to which we have dealt with the backlogs for the year end of March 2009. We had 22,000 backlogs at the end of March 2009. Now, the red figure is just to indicate that the extent to which we have really, through the collaboration of departments, worked hard to make sure that we reduce the backlogs. We are at 14, but if you look at what the real problems are on the backlog, is the backlogs or the exit applications which are more than a year, because those are mostly problematic cases where you've got divorce cases, where there are disputes with many wives or whatever, where children are in dispute. So these are not easily resolvable. You really need time and you need legal intervention at times. So that's the problem that we have. And if you look at that column, that last column, GPFS at the end of March 2009, we were sitting with cases of that nature to the tune of 2,899. And as employer, these are the cases that came to us, and we returned to them because there was a gap in information. As employer, we sent back 4,087. And at SARS, because SARS also, when you, the SARS column, honorable members, are cases that have been finalized by GPF. No problem with us, we said this person is right, he must get paid, then we'll refer these cases to SARS. And SARS says, no, the tax affairs are not in order. So you can't release the money. So that is the column there. And we have embarked on a program to educate members to really work with SARS to clean up their tax affairs. So I think, yeah.
Chairperson, before we move on, the other problem that we have discovered as a new board is that the operating technology, the operating platform for it's archaic, it's quite old, and most of the things are being done manually. As a teacher, if you are in Bochum from my province, you retire, your exit documents must be submitted to the district, to the region, the province, and national, and finally to the GPF. That process is tedious and is bound to create problems. And as a new board, we have pledged to invest a lot of resources to get a new platform that would enhance that speedy interaction between the employer department and the GPF. I think that's the point that I just want to make.
It's very important, Chair. Chair, I'm not going to dwell much. I think I tried to cover in terms of what we do to close the gap of the lack of appropriate technology automation to service us. We've got regional offices now throughout the country to which members go there for assistance.
Okay. Just a sec.
In terms of the GEP law, we are required to pay within 60 days. So the 60 days, that's what's required by the law, and then the 61, 90, those are other days. And that gives you an impression of our performance. And hence the explanation that was being given by Mr. G of the reasons why you have this type of case.
Yeah, so just to add, this 61 upward would be what we call backlogs. When you say backlogs, we refer all unpaid benefits in excess of 60 days. This one, sir, I've already said we've got a regional office in all the provinces. We've got, in addition, in the absence of the appropriate technology, land lesson officers. These are the people who sit in the regional offices and go to talk to departments and help them to deal with these challenges. And in order to minimize matters, we also deal with public protector, because we don't report to the pension adjudicator. So public protector is the official link that we deal with. These are just where the regional offices are. As I've already indicated, we work now closely with employers to educate them on their role, and going forward we also are going to educate employees. This is how we communicate with members, through newsletters, and just on the positive side, we are the winners of in terms of the Institute of Retirement Funds accolade, the winners of the best performing member newsletter. This is what we communicate to our members. We also won a prize on the large category fund, communication challenge. We also won a special mention in terms of the training and engagement. This is done by this institute to look at how we work in order to improve services to our members. We also do roadshows, exhibitions, community roadshows, just to make sure that we reach out to all these people. The initiatives, Chair, we have taken, I'm on now, service delivery initiatives. This problem of data quality that I've mentioned, we are also in GPF busy with cleaning the data that we have received, updating it with new records from employers, from members themselves. We've embarked on an 18-month program to make sure that we've got the clean data, and thereafter we maintain it with the collaboration of employers. I've already mentioned the MOU that we want to intend to sign with the new employees. Next slide. This is just the initiatives in terms of the ICT. We are saying we want the technology that works, but it's going to take us time to work there. And in the meantime, we are closing the gaps through all the efforts. The governance, Chair, now we've got an internal audit function which was not there before. We've got the risk management framework established. We've got the fraud prevention plan. And this is the area which is very, very hot, Chair, the fraud. And as at the reporting period, the GPF lost 1.3 million. Due to fraud.
something that we are fighting very hard. The clean break principle, I think you have heard about it. GPF does not currently comply to the clean break principle, but the board is busy with the investigation with a view to finally changing the GP law, because currently the GP law does not allow for the clean break principle. So once that work has been done, they will implement through the engagement through the Treasury and the PFCBC to make sure that it is implemented in terms of the private sector practice. Chair, the last slide is just to say the board and the minister have decided to separate the administration and the fund in terms of governance, and that work is ongoing. We hope that it will be finalized. This is now in line with the private sector practice where these roles are separated. Chair, I just want to say on the challenges, the last slide, just our challenges. I think we want to be aligned to the Pension Fund Act finally. The accurate and complete data members information, as we have already indicated, we want to make sure that this program works and we get the clean data so that we can timelessly exit members when they exit. At time of exit, member and pensioner education, then the system, the pension administration system is very important for us to do this other way. Otherwise, we will continue to have this problem. And finally, Chair, SGPF, we really want to keep our reputation, and the brand GPF must work for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Maybe before I allow honorable members to interact with this presentation, and indeed it's quite an elaborate subject matter, we will not be able to exhaust everything today, but I think it's a beginning and it's a good foundation for us to understand the issues that you are grappling with. Let me just indicate before I take your hand, honorable member, that we have received from the side of the finance family normally the presentations that come from the entities that fall within the Ministry of Finance, they are accompanied by the political champion in government, that's the Minister of Finance and the Deputy Minister. But in this instance, I must say we've received the apologies of the two, both the Deputy Minister and the Minister. The Minister is in Tanzania. Today is Wednesday. The Deputy Minister is in Cabinet. And equally, we have received an apology from the minister in the responsible for public service administration and his deputy. So I just wanted to indicate that it is a normal practice that normally when we interact with entities that report in a particular line ministry, those political representatives are always present. So I just wanted to say in advance this. We did receive those apologies. Honorable member, because, you know, we have got two committees in here, you'll assist in terms of those that are quite familiar with yourself, honorable co-chairperson.
Maybe before we actually proceed, I just needed to get an indication, because I've seen that governance didn't go into details, to find out if are there no key issues, because part of why you actually made this joint committee is to actually, while interacting with you on issues that relate particularly to finance, we also look into issues that fall within governance, and it might be of importance for these committees joined together if there are issues that you think need to be flagged out even before the race ends, because my worry is that you might find that they start raising issues that you actually wanted to flag on. If you do not have such, then it's fine. We can proceed to the questions. And just to emphasize the fact that there is a purpose why we actually brought the committees together. We know for a fact that largely the institution falls under finance. There are aspects of the institution that fall within a Department of Public Safety and Administration. And therefore, this joint committee has to achieve on those areas both, so that we don't call you for finance, call you next time for the other matter, and we wanted you to collectively deal with that. Should we proceed to questions? Okay. Okay, honorable members, I'm going to take three hands first, and the rest I'll just know them and I'll follow with them. I can see there's a hand, Honorable Mutimele, followed by Honorable Maluleke, Honorable Dreyer, and then I'll take other hands as I move on. Honorable Mutimele, you're on the floor.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just observed an interesting cultural behavior in this committee, in this board. I think there is a respect for the elders. Maybe it's because the chairperson is young. I see you as Mr. Gilles trying to talk. Arthur will switch on the microphone for him and put it on his mouth. That is a good culture. I'm very much interested about this investment in the oil rigs in Nigeria. Because as we read about Nigeria, there is always a political conflict, and the source of that conflict is the oil. And some men have been hanged in Nigeria for that conflict. Now I'm just checking what are your criteria if you invest in such conflict areas. Well, how do you make sure that our investment will be secured? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Maluleke.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, on page 28, they stated that they have regional offices on all 9 provinces, and they deployed the client agent services and client liaison officers. But we are still having the challenges, Chairperson. We don't know the monitoring system of these officers. We are still having challenges on the update of the information of the members, where almost their date of employment, they find it always wrong, and where they update their information. But when they make follow-ups, they always find the old information on the system. The other one is on the filling forms of the exit, where people will fill forms, and when they make follow-up, they will tell them that their forms are expired. We want to know how they interact with people who fill the forms to make them aware of the shortage of documents. And the other one is that people will wait for their pension fund. Some are even die waiting for those pension funds. And if a person is in a rural area where maybe the spouse doesn't understand the processes of this pension fund, what is happening about the pension fund of the partner? Because they will sit down not knowing that where should they go, and there is no information to tell them that there is money from their partners. And then, Chair, this question that I'm asking more in at Northwest, because particularly there are people complaining in Northwest. And the other one, lately, last week, was happening on the TV, where the person was the principal and he did fill the forms for this pension fund, and only to find that they paid another person with under her name. So he just sits for 5 years not having his funds. So how did he have to know what is happening about his man when he doesn't make any follow-up? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Maluleke. Honorable Dreyer, you'll be followed by Honorable George, and we'll allow the presenter to respond before we take a second batch of it. I've noted all of you. Honorable Dreyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to start off by thanking both of the both of you, the two co-chairs, for calling the joint meeting. And I think that's very useful that we, these two committees particularly, sit together from time to time because there's a huge overlap. But I was also looking forward very much to seeing the relevant ministers here because I have some specific questions to especially the Minister of Public Service. Now, I value the input and the presentation we had here from the Government Employees Public Pension Fund, but I have some questions for the minister. Now he's not here, and the buck really stops with the minister. It falls ultimately politically under him. So I'm going to still put my questions, and hopefully we as a committee or a joint committee could relay the questions to the minister. I'm concerned about the data, the quality of data, and the presenters have highlighted that to us. And it's not a unique problem to this particular entity. I attended a presentation by Statistics South Africa a while ago. What did they say? The data that they rely on is not, or they have to trust the data, but it's not reliable. It comes from various government departments. What do we hear from the Government Employees Public Fund? The data they gather from the departments is not reliable, and then ultimately it affects the pensioners or the supposed beneficiaries. And it brings me to PASOL, because you also mentioned PASOL specifically, and I've raised that in my portfolio committee, a number of vacancies in the civil service, across the civil service, all departments. And the minister then disputes the information and says, oh no, but PASOL is not correct, it's not reliable. But we've heard that excuse for years, in fact. With the previous minister still there, she said, but PASOL is going to be sorted out, and PASOL, we've heard that promise, and PASOL is still not sorted out. Now, again, it's being raised today. So it's become an historical problem, and it's being used as an excuse year after year that PASOL is under review, PASOL is being fixed. It's not being fixed. So my question to the minister was going to be, and it's, I hope that the committee would take it up with the minister, when will PASOL be fixed? We've just appointed a National Planning Commission, very high level. They're going to do planning for the whole country. They have to rely on data in order to do their planning. If they don't get correct data, they can't do proper planning. So it's extremely important problem. It goes to the heart of the matter. So PASOL must be fixed. Thank you, Madam or Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Dreyer. Honourable George.
Thank you, Chairperson. There's a lot of information here, specifically in the report, so I have a few more questions than usual, but I'll be brief. On page number 9 of the annual report, we see a photograph of the principal officer. The principal officer seems to have left the fund rather abruptly, so my question is, why did she leave, and is she taking legal action against the fund? On page number 11, there is reference to the chief executive officer. Now, it is, I know that you speak about governance in this instance, but for example, the Eskom Pension Fund has a CEO who actually is the principal officer. So why is it that there is a CEO and the principal officer? What it looks like is that the CEO in this instance is the head of administration, but I'd like some clarity on that. And then page number 37, give an overview of the fund benefits, and it talks about retirement benefits, but it doesn't specifically say what the formula is. Now, I know that it's a defined benefit fund, so there's obviously a formula, a percentage per year of service, but specifically my question is, did any employee receive a benefit more than the formula, and if there is a process for this? So, for example, if somebody joins the fund and then they retire subsequently, is there ever a process where they would get more years or a higher formula than set out in the rule. Then on page number 38, under accumulated funds and reserves, I see that in 2008, interest paid to members was 1.56 billion, and then in 2009 it was 2.22 billion. That says that the interest, that's usually interest paid on a claim that is pending, I would expect. That number has gone up reasonably substantially. Does that mean that members are waiting longer to get the money? That seems obvious, but if you can just explain it. And then on the administration expenses, it looks like it's a 60 million increase in administration expenses from 8 to 9, which does seem a bit excessive. If you could just explain that. And then page number 40, on the actuarial valuation, where it talks about some of the actuarial liabilities and a number of reserves that are not fully funded, what steps are going to be taken to fund them, if any? And then on the table 17, the valuation results at the end of March 2008, the contingency reserve, reserve for data, so data and contingency reserve, was six billion in 2006, and it's now 24. Does that mean that your data is getting worse and therefore you need to make more reserves available for erroneous data? Or I'm not sure if you could explain that. And then there is a paragraph underneath that where it talks about the salary increases that were higher than anticipated, the ones that were actually awarded. I mean, this is pretty obvious. If the salary continues to escalate beyond the assumption made by the actuary, government is going to have to top the fund up more and more. So what steps are you taking to mitigate this risk? Because obviously government employee salaries do seem to be escalating faster than anticipated, and certainly faster than private sector salaries. Then on page number 46, where you're talking about on the number of 1.4 reserves above the table, it talks about the accounting provision for the reserve set aside to address past discriminatory practices. Do you have a policy on addressing that, and if so, would we be able to see it? And then on page number 50, on the statement of net assets and funds, on the contributions receivable on current assets, in 2008, at the end of the financial year, it was 318 million, and then 2009, 524, which says that out of the contributions outstanding at the end of the year were higher than before. Now, I know there's a delay in receiving the contributions, but are the contributions actually being received on time, or is that number increasing? And then in benefits payable, that number is also increasing from 2008 to 9, from 13 billion to 18. So that's obviously reflecting a backlog in claims. You've confirmed that, but I just want to know whether that is why it is that way. And then just briefly on the presentation, I'm nearly there, Chair. On page number 19, on page number 19, on the actuarial valuation, I know there's an interim valuation in 2009, and it gives a result of a funding level of 91.5%. Now, if we look at 2006, it was 101%, so the fund was more than fully funded, and then in 2008, it was 100% funded, according to the actuary. So it's deteriorating the funding level, which obviously means that if it carries on going that way, the taxpayer will need to fund, I know that there's intergenerational cross-subsidization with members coming into the fund, etc., but this is not a healthy picture, I don't think, certainly if it carries on that way. So what steps are actually being taken to sort that one out? Then on page number 20, No, sorry, I'm going to skip that one. On page number 20, I just want to make a point about where you talk about developmental investing is about identifying investment opportunities that will generate excellent investment returns with a high positive social impact. That is a good principle. However, the bottom line is this fund cannot tolerate suboptimal returns given the state of the valuation anyway. So I just would like to know whether you are actually also looking at the risk of suboptimal returns. I know that social investing does not necessarily mean a poor return, but it is possible. And then on page number 25, I'll skip that one. And then 27, also skip that one. 42, yes. You mentioned that you've separated the administration now from the governance part of the fund. And we also know a few pages after, and I would have liked to ask them this question, but I'll ask it to you anyway, about the functions of this new administration entity with this little pie chart on page number 51. We talked about administration and it talks about other pension funds. So I'm starting now to equate in my own mind about retirement reform. Is this the precursor then, this administration arm? Is this the precursor to the retirement reform process where there will be this entity that will be administering a government pension fund that is not the employees' pension fund but the actual national savings fund? I'd like to know if you know about that. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, just to indicate that I still have got about six or so honourable members would want to ask questions and comment, and we don't have the whole of this afternoon. I would request that we should try to limit our questions, and there'll be a follow-up probably outside this session, so that other entities that are here should also be given optimal opportunity to present their case before the honourable members. Over to you, Chairperson.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. The first question on oil rigs in Nigeria, our head of investment, John Oliphant, would answer that. He's part of the investment committee of the Pan-African Infrastructure Development Fund. On the question by Honorable Maluleke on regional offices, the updating of information of members on date of employment, all the information, exit documentation, benefits to surviving spouse will be dealt by, be handled by Ms. Manditi Gola, our Chief Operating Officer. The issue of the principal we've addressed it. Mr. Chiesit, we can repeat that, but we did address that. The question by Honorable Dreyer is on data quality on PESEL. I'm not sure whether this is, we can respond to that, but I don't think it's our area to be passing comments on PESEL. I mean, that's an area that belongs to the Department of Public Service and Administration. We can talk about the challenges that we encounter, but Mantinti would be able to deal with that. The question by Dr. George on legal action will deal with that. I'll speak to that one on the former principal officer. All questions on actual valuation and, would be dealt by our head of investment and actual services, Mr. John Oliphant. There's a question also on contribution receivable, benefit payable. Our CFO, Ms. Hanan Chigila, will deal with those questions. The developmental investment framework, risk of suboptimal returns. I would ask the head of investment to deal with that one. Mr. Chia will talk about the other pension. That I reflected on the pie chart. I think I've captured all the questions of the members. There's a question on page 38 on interest paid to members. I would ask the Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Hannah Ziegler, to deal with that one. And the administration expenses, increasing my administration expenses, I would ask Mrs. Mantitukula and the CFO to deal with that one. So I think honorable members have managed to capture all your questions. Can we start with Mr. John Oliphant?
Over to you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. I mean, we need to look at the actual structure of the fund. The Pan-African Infrastructure Development Fund, it's a fund that is managed like a trust, and you've got a lot of investors participating in that fund. So the GEPF, it's got an exposure of about 39% in that fund by contributing $250 million. And then the second largest investor in that fund is the APSA Capital, which put in almost 11% into that fund. And you've got other South African financial institutions, and then you've got other entities in the African continent that have invested in that. So all the investments then are done through processes through the PINDF. Currently, PINDF itself as a fund is managed by Harris Fund Managers, whose their role to go around to search for appropriate projects within the African continent, and then they come and present them to the investment committee of the PINDF and then to the board of the PINDF. In relation to the investments in oil rigs, what we're owning is just the oil rigs that are drilling in the waters there in Nigeria to get the oil out. But in instances where, because I don't want to refer only to one specific example, because the issue of political stability and so forth will always crop up when you deal with African issues. So in instances where there is a perceived risk in relation to that, we sometimes opt to take an insurance cover to ensure that we protect the funds. And then we also ensure that the investments that we invest in, we've got local participation in terms of shareholding. For example, the investment in question, we've got the largest investor in there is the First Bank of Nigeria. So there's a lot of interest that the First Bank of Nigeria has put into that investment. But in instances where we perceive that there's high risk, we either move away or we take the necessary political risk. But I think more or less that answers the question. Sorry, Chair.
All the other questions.
Okay. The other question was related to the actuarial valuation, honorable, which indicated that in 2006 we had a funding level of about 100.2%, and then in 2008 was 100%, and in the interim, which is not yet an official report, we had a funding level of 91%. I think what we need to look at, we need to understand what happened economically between the two periods. The first thing that is important is that you'll appreciate that this fund has got a high exposure to growth assets as per the strategic asset allocation. We've got, on average, we've got 50% exposure to listed equities, and then we also have some exposure to properties, listed properties. So that is a significant portion of the investment. So what happens is that in a period of economic crisis, we know what happened in equities. So if you take 2006, we are almost at the top of the bull market, if you want to call that. And then in 2008, when or 2009, we are almost at the bottom of the cycle. So we did that valuation at the bottom of the cycle. So that's one of the reasons why the actuary of the fund found it not necessary to review contribution rates. Because when you are at the bottom of the cycle, we are more likely to recover and get greater returns. And we've already experienced that. I mean, if you look at the where the assets are sitting as at 31 March 2009, although they are not yet audited, we're already sitting at 819 billion. So you can see that there's a greater growth of assets relative to the liability. So if we are to perform the valuation as of 31 March 2010, which is what the board intends to do, you will actually see a better picture. But we must understand that all these things are linked also to economic cycles. You know, I mean, other issues around it is that one would say that at the bottom of the cycle, if you read the statutory report, is that one would say that it's better to increase the equity risk premium that you build into the valuation rate. And if you increase that, if you discount liabilities at a higher rate, they'll probably appear to be lower. But given the levels of prudence that actuaries like to practice, they prefer not to change the valuation rate and kept it as constant. And as such, that's why the fund appear to slightly artificial to look like as if it's in a strain. But I can confidently say that we've nicely recovered and the position is looking extremely good. We're just waiting for the real numbers as at 31 March 2009. Obviously, there'll be issues that would also affect the liability side of the equation. And we will also want to investigate that there are issues related to OSDs, occupation-specific dispensation. That could literally increase salaries at higher rates than previously assumed, which I think you highlighted earlier on. So that impact also will increase the liability. So we would recover, but you know, will not recover to the extent that we'd have liked if the OSD was not in place. But I think from our side and from the board side is that if there are going to be significant changes to salary structures, it will always almost be useful if they are smoothed out so that we reflect a better picture for the liability. But you must remember that when you increase salaries, it means increased future contributions into the fund because you've got a higher salary going forward. The only thing that you hope for is that the member does not get a high salary and exit within the 2 years because they'll get an artificially higher benefit. I think I've covered most of your question around the valuation. On the issue of the social responsible investment, and I think in your point, Honourable Member, you referred that by making these investments, you don't necessarily have to compromise returns. And that's what truly came out of our research. Our research shows that if you're going to invest in assets that are illiquid, as an investor, you need to be compensated for that. You need to get higher returns. So what we did, we drew a spectrum of possible opportunities. So we know that where the returns are not good, either charity, whatever, that is a role for government to invest in those projects. Where returns maybe are slightly lower to our appetite, that's a role for developmental institutions to play. What we are playing in is to moving our portfolio from a low social impact to a high social impact while maintaining the returns that we require. And the returns that this fund require is we want to target at least 3% real, so on top of inflation. So those are the type of investment opportunities we're talking about in a developmental space. And I usually like mentioning an example, although I will not mention an institution. And that example is, for example, the church in Soweto, the Grace Bible Church. They sought financing so that they could build a church. They went to the banks. They could not qualify for the loan and so forth. They went to a particular institution, which is an SRI fund, and they said, these are the books that we've got. We'll be able to pay the loan. Please give us money to build our church. And that happened. And within less than 5 years, that was paid off. You know, between me and you, how long it takes to pay our mortgage bonds. So those are the type of opportunities that we're talking about. I mean, I would like to say that I'm sorry to have mentioned certain institutions. It was not the intention, but it was just to demonstrate an example of the type of opportunities we're talking about. And really, with the four-pillar strategy that we talked about, we know that there is a lot of investment opportunities in different areas that were highlighted by our chairman. Yes, if the investment returns, they don't make sense, we'll walk away. We want to invest in projects that will generate good returns. I mean, I don't want to take too long, but that area, I think, is closer to us, especially given the need to diversify the portfolio. So you need to have a lot of assets that will not move in the same direction when you experience the economic crisis. So you want certain assets to hold up while others might behave differently, so that at least through an economic crisis, you are able to come out as we came out in this instance. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. In response to Honorable Maluleke's questions about the regional offices and the deployment of the customer liaison officers, in response to our inaccessibility, we did roll out new regional offices in 2008 to present. We increased our footprint from 4 to 13. Initially, when the board took over, it was only the Pretoria, the Polokwane, and the Mafikeng office and Visho. And now we do have representation in all the provinces. In addition, we do have satellite offices in Johannesburg and also in PE in the Eastern Cape. Then I will tie this response to the increase in the administration cost, because the setting up and the resourcing of this additional 8 offices, that's what gave rise to the increase in the administration cost. And if you look at the number of client liaison officers that we have, which currently we have 42, and we look at our membership and our employer department base, which is spread geographically across the entire country, although it's a good move now to interact with the employer and the members through this model, it is not sustainable in terms that would like the departments to have resources in terms of personnel and also have the infrastructure and technology going forward so that we can interface with them electronically. With respect to data quality, we have introduced a number of initiatives around member education, and we have adopted non-conventional ways of going to your townships like Lebowakgomo, Galeshewe, and move away from the metropolis, because that's where most of our membership is concentrated. And in these road shows, we spend a day at that particular area, and we bring customer service agents and CLOs who address member queries on site. But above that, we educate even the non-members, especially your spouses and other stakeholders, your unions, and all interest parties about the benefits that we paid and how does one get to acquire those benefits, or what are the channels for one to inquire about the existence of such benefits. With regards to data, we have implemented an information quality improvement project, and that project is looking at our internal processes, how we can enhance the way we deal with data. We're looking also at the member, making the members aware of their responsibility with making sure that if there's a change in the life cycle of their membership with us, they make it a point that they remind the employer to send that kind of information to the fund. So we're looking at a double thought where we educate the member and also we educate the employers. And also we look in a bid to improve the quality of our data. We also are acquiring data from third parties. And the one company that we approached is GEMS that are present here with us. We also approach SARS, and we're also looking at other commercial third-party data vendors so that we can really look at this data question. And the issue of benefit payment, on the issue of benefit payment, like the chairperson has alluded earlier, we're 100% reliant on all facets of our value chain. When the member is admitted, we rely 100% on the employer to make sure that we admit the member and all member details are correct, and make sure that the contributions are paid, make sure that everything that relates to the exit documentation is submitted accurately. And when we encounter in the...
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt, ma'am. What I wanted to indicate is that now we definitely have a time crisis. What I'm going to request after you have just summed up, please sum up, I'm going to actually allow all the questions to be asked so that once we finalize, all other questions have been sort of covered. I'm giving you to sum up in terms of explanation so that I move on with questions.
In addition, our service channels, how the member can get hold of us, we have a dedicated call center, and members in those provinces can walk into these regional offices and they will be assisted in the language of their preference at the call center and also at the regional offices. Thank you.
Honorable members, let me just indicate that on the list we do have Honorable Soft, who will actually make a question now. Will be followed by Honorable Dubazan, will be followed by Honorable Williams, then Honorable Bikani, Honorable Suka, I know this is a last name, Honorable Liang. Oh, we might have skipped your name. We will include it. Okay, so as you can see, the list is long. I am going to take you in that order, starting with Honorable Swift.
Thank you, Chair. You cut me off already. Chair, I'll be very quick. Just on the sustainable investments that delivers both good investment returns and high social and environmental impact. It looks, it's separated out at the moment. It looks like 6% at the moment, but you are thinking of moving that up to a level of 35%. Is that correct? Do I understand you correctly or not? In any case, whatever that might be, irrespective of that, could they in future, please, as a request, not a question, just in future show us, separate out those investments in that area that did not perform according to expectations.
Honorable Tubazana.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is not going to be a question, and I really don't expect answers, because I appreciate that the GPF is here and you have made this interaction, but I'm also very a bit disappointed. We are still debating on the debt information, which is 2008-2009 information, even the numbers, everything, your report, 2008-2009, and even the very same information, the financials, or the are not audited to this date. Okay, fine. If they're audited, we appreciate that, Chair. GEPF is the largest client of the PIC, but they haven't met with the PIC to this date. This is the report, misunderstood what the Chair said, that they are supposed to meet on the 14th of May. I don't know, but I think that's what I heard, that you are still have to meet with the PIC. Now, that's why I'm saying, Honorable Chairs, I don't have questions because they don't have information. The PIC are the managers of this, and you are the biggest, the largest. In fact, you're supposed to meet with them in 2 days' time because you are the bosses. So in other words, I'm getting a picture here or a perception that the PIC is, they will go there if they want to. It's 4 or 5 months now the board is on board. And the PIC is still not giving us the information regarding the range of the five sectors or classes of the investors, all the equities. We had recession. These numbers that we're seeing here, are they still the same regarding the accumulated funds, reserves, losses and income, like what Honorable George asked? Are we still sitting in the same numbers? I'm sure the answer is no. So what about the write-offs between the PIC, the NetBank, the GEPF? What about it? We don't have that. So I am requesting, Honorable Chairs, that when we meet next time, and we need to meet with the GPF as quickly as possible because we don't have information. I come from the finance, and I'm really very, I'm panicking about the information that the PIC is not coming forth, and we need to know about these things. Who are these stakeholders? And what is happening? As we were driving yesterday, we saw the old ladies, the mamas, and they're still fighting for their pension from the mines. They've been working from the mines for so many years, And it's embarrassing to the ANC-led government what is happening. So, Honorable Chair, I said I don't need an answer here, but I am requesting that I propose that as a way forward, the GPF make sure that they meet with the PIC by tomorrow, because they are the largest client. They can just switch off the taps. And that's it, and get other people that are going to deliver according to their. Have they aligned the five priorities and the 12 outcomes which were laid by the ANC-led government? Did that happen to their activities? We are not too sure as the committee, as the parliament. We are not too sure. And we want to touch this. We want to feel it. Right now it's far from us. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Duwazana. Dr. Williams?
Thank you, Chairperson. The question I've got, in the presentation that you made, you kept telling us that there was problems with data, and then it's all the records that you're receiving from the beneficiaries. But then you came later with your answers and said that there are mechanisms in place in order to correct this. But it seems to me that you're not connected to the ground at all. So although you might have offices out there, you are the biggest pension fund in the country, and yet you're not connected to the people on the ground. And I think that although you've come up with a plan, you need to give us, you know, when will you be connected to the ground? When will the backlogs be dealt with? Instead of saying we're just going to halve it every year. You know, if you keep halving forever. You never come to the end of that. You've got to be more than half so that you can come to the end. Thank you, Chairperson.
Maybe Kani?
Won't be locked on my. Thank you, Chair. I'm now mainly interested in the public service administration part of the whole story here. We hear the presentation, and I also think that I need to comment about the fact that I also feel that you seem to be in a little corner somewhere far away from the rest of the people. I'm saying this because there's an issue mentioned here that the DPSA is mainly concerned with the parcel system. But what I don't understand is if you've got a problem with them giving you the information correctly, then how is it that you're not working in coordination? So I'd like to know as to how best do you have coordinated work with the DPSA to ensure that I do feel that the parcel system does affect you. And the parcel system affecting you does affect operations within DPSA. Where do you connect, or when do you connect to try and help improve the system? This then also says, in terms of ICT, you've got something then about ICT as part of your delivery initiative. And I know for a fact that in the public service there's a lot of problems when it comes to systems within ICT not running well. With what you have there, how well coordinated is it then again with the DPSA? Because without the DPSA being connected to you and you being connected to them, I don't see how you are then going to eventually finalize your issue of backlogs in terms of payouts. And then the other thing, there's something on page 18 about a revised investment mandate that you need to go through with the PIC. I was also just interested in knowing how far are you with that process. I don't want to repeat myself with what the other speakers have said, so I'll go that far in terms of that question. And then, Chair, I would have appreciated it, both Chairpersons and recognition, I would have appreciated it if, in terms of the service delivery initiative and the challenges that you've laid out, if you could perhaps possibly get a report of a detailed strategic framework with time frames attached to it, so that you are able to determine if there is really progress or hurdles in terms of progress. Because the way it's put now in the presentation, it's just telling us that it's something to be done. Whether it is done, has it started, or it's at a particular point, it's not really indicated for us to can determine whether we can start being critical or bring in some ideas or whatever the case might be. But your service delivery initiative needs to be attached to time frames or have a detailed plan. And it would be greatly appreciated if that could be submitted to possibly both committees for us to can then determine what type of a follow-up do we need to make with them. It's the same also with the ICT, this ICT pyramid that they just presented to us as part of the document. That also needs to be put into actually a detailed framework for us to be able to determine where the problems are. Somewhere, somehow, I do feel that, in as much as you feel that your connection with DPSA is limited, it's not going to answer a lot of our questions that we might need to put forth in terms of progress of the people are presenting to us now. Thank you, Chair.
I think the next person is Honorable Suka, followed by Honorable Luyenge. He will then be followed by Honorable Koronov, who has since given up the opportunity to speak. And the last one is Honorable Des Van Rooyen. Can we move in that order?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I will scale down dramatically my questions because I had many questions for this presentation. But I am swayed by the previous speakers who were going to talk about the relationship of the presenters vis-a-vis the people who are supposed to do their work. So I would want to wait for their responses so that I can make a follow-up on those. But Chairperson, I think also I must say I appreciate this presentation first and foremost. Surely it's work in progress. I know that they will not overcome all obstacles in one day given their mandate and their time in office. So surely there's a working document that we can critique for the improvement of their mandate. Because I would have loved, Chairperson, on page 22, to see on pillar number 4 for them to go to town about this matter, to explain a little bit more, because it is a contentious issue, this that they've raised here, and yet there's nothing underneath that explains the progress thereof, or neither the challenges that they're encountering in that regard. So I would want, I would have loved to see more on that, but because of time constraints. The second issue, Chairperson, is on the document that deals with, on page 37, their success is in terms of when fighting crime or corruption or whatever. I know they said in one of their sentences that the cases are on an advanced stage in as far as the investigation is concerned. But to what extent that advanced stage is not yet clear to me, because they've almost said nothing to me if they say the case is, you know, cases are in advanced stages of the investigation. One would have loved to see a faster movement in that regard, and also the outcome of that, given the fact that they stated that there are about 115 alleged cases of fraud and 55 registered with subs. In real terms, so what does that mean, if you translate it into real terms? Any people who have been found guilty and prosecuted, how much have we made in terms of the recovery out of that? Because if you see fraud, something else, it means also with value, one way or another. So I'm saying I would love to see much more information going through us, but I know because of time factor that I'm unable. I'm saying they must not give up, just be smarter and be faster. We will visit your offices. I'm glad that, because when I look into your annual report on the last pages, you do give us where your offices are located. During the recess, I will visit my constituents and check and get much more details with your offices, so that I've got a little bit of more background in as far as the operations and the successes and the challenges thereof. Thank you, Chairperson.
Luyang.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I think I'm covered to a large extent by the previous speakers, especially in relation to the issue of stakeholder participation and shareholding. And the question that I have now, Chair, relates to the underwriting determination. How do you determine your underwriter? Do you follow the normal supply chain procedures? And also, how do you interact with the departments in relation to get information as to who will be leaving the service, and you'll be paying that particular person in a particular financial year? Do you have systems that actually informs you exactly as to how would you avoid further backlogs? Lastly, do your benefits include or consider the automatic inflation management? The last one, I guess, very last one, was on the suspense account. Do you have any suspense account, or if no, how do you deal with unclaimed monies as an organization? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just on the annual report, page 19, where you deal with the remuneration of trustees, I just want to show that, you know, if we take, for instance, a certain Mr. Andrew, he has attended about 21 meetings. He's being paid 568,000. That's an average of 27,000 rand a meeting. If you go to Vice Admiral Becker, he has attended 18 meetings. He's being paid 152,000. That's about 8,000 a meeting. And if you go to Ms. F. Peterson, she has attended 9 meetings. She's being paid 469,000. That's 52,000 rand a meeting. I just want to know why. Why is the difference? And the second question is, why do you need 28 trustees to run this business? Or is it by law that you are obliged to do that? Then if you go to page 47, if you look at your asset management, you know, basically you say it in the report that it's primarily run by the PIC, but you have just now appointed 9 new asset managers and 3 new property asset managers. I want to know, was there a proper procurement system in place, and why was it really necessary to add 12 new asset managers to the portfolio of the PIC? And then finally, I see that you do have quite an investment in Eskom. Were there any new approaches by Eskom to raise the investment?
Dev, the last one.
Thank you, Chair. If I also, I mean, welcome the presentation. I would one question and one suggestion. Firstly, the question, Chair. I'm very much interested on getting the details around the broader aspects of the performance of the Pan-African in infrastructure fund, as well as Easy Buyer fund. So I just wanted to check, because of time constraints, we are unable to get the details of the two. If one can access such in the website of the institution, I would appreciate if we are advised on that. And then secondly, Chair, as a suggestion, it came to my attention that most institutions are not taking advantage of the fact that throughout the country we have what we call parliamentary constituency offices, which are meant to serve as one-stop centers to our constituencies. And I can see that one of the biggest challenges that the institution is facing is around outreach and the popularization of the institution, how it functions, and so people can start appreciating exactly what is it that they must do in terms of services that are rendered by the institution. So I will suggest that maybe the institution consider linking the operations of the regional offices as an attempt, of course, to enhance this outreach process with parliamentary constituency office, where constituents can be obviously educated and taken on board about the operation of this particular institution. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The chairperson of the, but there are only two chairpersons in this meeting, co-chairpersons. Now, what I'm going to request that we are going to afford you a three-minute rule. We know it's bombarded with all sorts of questions, so that each of the respondents should actually use that three minutes to go to the heart of what needs to be communicated to honorable members here. I did say earlier on that we still have got another presentation that we need to take. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. We'll do so. I just want to quickly, the honorable member did sign, he said our financial statement, our annual report is not audited. If you check page 43 of our annual report, there are four firms that have signed off on our annual report. So that statement is incorrect. The second statement that is made, can I repeat? I'm just, because there are time constraints. Our annual report has been signed off by four audit firms, so it's audited. The second point that you raised is our relationship with the PIC. I need to correct what you have said, because it's incorrect. There are three liaison committees that we have at an operational level with the PIC. That's the finance committee. There's a finance, there's an investment committee, there's a communication committee. They are meeting regularly. So the issue that we are not interacting with the PIC is an incorrect statement. We have got a very good relationship with the PIC. And as the chairman of the fund, I interact a lot of times with the chairperson of the PIC, who happens to be the Deputy Minister of Finance. So, I just wanted to correct that. I would ask Mantintukula to deal with the personal issue, the ICT connection, and I would ask Ntatechie to deal with the issue of fraud cases, and also Ms. Kula to deal with the detailed strategic framework. There's a question also on our Pillar 4. I would ask Head of Investment, John Olifant, to speak to that and in relation to the Inspire Fund and why currently we are sitting at a low rate. There's a question of the supply chain management. I'll leave it to the CFO. There's also issue of benefits and inflation. I would have to leave that to, I would assume it's pensioner benefits or whatever. I would have to leave it to the head of investment. Suspense account, the CFO will deal with that. And lane benefits, Mantintukola will deal with that one. The issue of payment of trustees, the acting principal officer, Ms. Van Niekerk, will deal with that question, and also on the number of trustees. On asset managers, why do we have external asset manager? I assume that's the question. You will deal with that, the head of investment. Whether we have been approached by ESCOM, I would ask the head of investment to deal with that. I'm sorry, there's a question. I'm not sure whether that's the first name. I'll just say Honorable Des. My apologies if I'm not using the correct designation. And on PIDF and EC Buyer Fund, whether we can't have any further information on that. We acknowledge or we'll take into consideration the views that have been expressed about the role of constituency office and would apply our minds to that. So those are the questions, and I would appeal to the respondents to be brief and to the point.
Maybe before Chairperson, there's also a question on page 46, just clarity. Under reserve account balance. The Siskai strikers. Who are these strikers?
The CEO will deal with that question. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Just to say, you see, in your background, where you come from,
you have indicated the amalgamation of various pension funds to create this particular fund that you are presiding over now. I can't remember where exactly. Yeah. It's page 5. It was born out of the amalgamation of TBVC, pension schemes. Now, in your report, you've got Cisco and Strikers. Just that, as you deal with the issue.
Okay. The CEO will deal with that one. Can I hand over to Mr. Unifant and then Mandindi, the CFO, Mr. Kie? I think that should be the acting principal officer.
Thank you, honorable members. I'll try to be brief on each question so that in the interest of time we manage to cover most of them. Just to deal on the issue of do benefits include any inflation management, I'll try to split it into two. I mean, when you talk about active members, we must remember that active members' benefits are based on their average salary, and average salary grows with inflation, so that's not an issue. When you talk to pensioners are the ones where the board have to decide on an annual basis based on the advice of the actuary what are the affordable pension increases. So, for example, you would see that in the time during the financial crisis, the board afforded pensioners a 9% increase, and then last year they gave them a 5% increase because inflation was very low. So the post-retirement, that is managed by the board, and we try and make sure that we maintain the pensioners at 100% of their pension at retirement, adjusted for full inflation. Okay. On the issue of the appointment of asset managers, I mean, I'm not going to try to be too technical. The issue is that the GEPF employs a strategy which we call a core satellite approach. For example, if you take the equity portfolio, it's sitting almost at about 400 billion. For you to be able to outperform the market, you would have to index most part of that. So most of part of that, which is the core, is managed internally at the PIC. But we don't want just to track the market. We want to generate a little bit of outperformance. Then that's when we appoint the external managers. And the external managers, they manage money according to different styles. Others are managing on a value strategy, others on a growth strategy, others on sector mandates, industrials, resources, and so forth. So it's what we call satellites, and their mandate is really to outperform the overall benchmark when we mix the overall portfolio. That is the whole idea around diversification and risk management, and so forth. On the issue of Pillar 4 and the progress thereof, the framework that the chairman referred to in his opening remarks, it was adopted by the board of the GEPF in February of this year, and it still has to be fully implemented. That's why you realize that on the ECBIA portfolio where we showed you the current allocation, the fund is sitting at 1%. So we haven't really invested that much. So we're only going to start investing. But I must say that the challenges with investing in this area are quite huge, and it's one of the things that we need to think about thoroughly, because chasing an investment deal of 20 million involves the same amount as chasing an investment deal of 1 billion. And when you've got such a huge amount to invest, you need to check on how you allocate the resources. So you might find that it's one area that will take some time to be able to get to a level where we would feel comfortable. On the issue of the PINDF and the EC buyer, I think we need to alert the honourable member that, you know, when you deal with private equity, it's not the same as dealing with listed equities. When you look at the JSE, it's easy to see what was the closing price, what went up, what went down. When you deal with the unlisted investments, you have to sit down physically with the independent valuators and try and estimate what is the value of that investment. And then that's when you will start being able to say what type of returns you have made and so forth. So on an annual basis, the board puts a subcommittee which looks at all unlisted investments, and they come up with a value of each of those investments. And I mean, I think for the intents and purposes of transparency, I don't see any challenges in making that report available to the committee. But what is important is that you must understand that the values that will be in those type of reports are subjective, because the only time you realize the return is when you actually sell the investment. Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Co-Chair. With regard to the issue of the quality of data and that of PESAL and PESOL, our relationship with the DPSA or the employer department is that of partnership, because without them we cannot execute our mandate. So we do have interaction at all levels, operational, tactical, and strategic. And the same holds with PESAL. And we also are partaking in the recent developments that are looking at the improvement of PESAL. We are partaking in those meetings, because we rely 100% on the input that is from PESAL with regard that we are a defined benefit, and the contribution, the salary and the pensionable service, we deduce all those from PESAL. So our relationship is inseparable, and that we are partners in this regard. And we do collaborate and speak on a daily basis. With regard to the CISCI strikers, is one of the categories of the past discriminatory practices as outlined in the agreements of the PSCBC, and of which the three biggest categories are your NSF and the CISCI and that of the general assistance. So in collaboration with the DPSA and the PSCBC, we are working with them based on the agreements that they reach to make sure that we duly recognize the members' past discriminated pensionable service.
No, this is just to add. It is as a result of the civil servants who were fired by Brigadier Koso in 1992 after they waged a strike in favor of the incorporation into South Africa. They came back into the system around 1996. So the pension lapse, the gap, is what they are demanding, and government has said we must look into each case and pay back, compensate for their pension loss.
Thank you. Notwithstanding the challenges that we contend with regard to data, we are making headway with regard to the reduction of backlogs. If you look on slide 27, we ended up the year with 20,000 backlogs, and we managed to reduce that by 37% through the collaboration and cooperation of the employer departments, working with the CLOs and the regional offices on exit payments that exceeds that 60-day KPI. Another thing is if we look at the average number of exit cases that we receive monthly, we are currently, as of March 2010, looking at about 4.6 average of exit payments that we receive, and we are on average paying about 5.2, meaning that if we take care of the backlog and together with the employer departments, we're able to trace these members and make sure that the exit documentation is properly filled, would comfortably be able to deal with the incoming as it normalizes. Another thing is, once the board and the other stakeholders have agreed on the automation process, where our interaction with the employer or that interface will be automated and other internal processes are automated, we'll see a quantum leap and we'll be able to meet and even to exceed that 60-day turnaround time.
Hannah, just a quick one.
Thank you, Honorable Co-Chair. I'm just going to quickly handle the questions that were raised by Honorable George. And also, Honorable Muyenge, with regard to the interest paid and the administration expenses and contributions receivable and benefits payable and the suspense account and unclaimed benefits. Now, I'm mindful of the fact that we don't have much time. So on page 38 of the annual report, the interest paid to members increased from 1.56 to 2.22. Now, if you look at the slide, at our presentation on page 27, you will see that what has been alluded to by the CEO and the COO as reducing our backlog. What happened is for backlogs that for benefits that have been there for more than 60 months, the interest that is accruing to them, it has not been, you know, because of the weaknesses of our systems, it had to be done manually. So now if a person is claiming and we're addressing a backlog for more than 60 months, then we have to do a manual calculation. 60 months for this one, for the backlog. So now if you look at this, it actually talks also to the benefits payable that have increased on page 74, interest paid to members, which is for, you know, like compared to the benefits payable of 2008, which was 2.64.0. Because now we are addressing a lot of backlogs, and those that have been, like if you look to page 27 of our slide, those that have been there for more than 366 days from 1.3, you know, from 2.8 to 1.3. So that's that. And on administration expenses paid, we've also spoken about client interface and the fact that we have increased the footprint. So that's from page number 28 of our slide. So that has actually increased our administration expenses. Now, on contributions receivable, well, on page, which is on our, on contributions receivable, on page 50 of the annual report, those were mainly, you know, like those were three employers. It's Limpopo Education and Agriculture and CPRO. They actually paid a little bit late, so, you know, like we did recover that after the end of March. That was accrued from them. And you would see that in the notes to the annual financial statements on note number 7, you would see that basically it's the employer contributions that have increased compared to the previous year. If you look at 2008, it was 311 and it increased to 521. That talks to those three. And we've got, now we've implemented measures to make sure that they pay upfront, they pay much faster. And on the unclaimed benefits, we do trade, you know, like we've got a process in place whereby we track the people whose benefits we have not paid to make sure that we pay them in time. So we reconcile our suspense accounts consistently. We didn't even have a finding from external audit with regard to this. I think I've just tried to summarize that in a nutshell. Thank you.
Ms. Van Nicker on the trustee expenses and the number of trustees, and then the last one would be Mr. Chia on the fraud case.
Thank you, Honorable Kaya Chain. To answer the questions regarding the different remuneration, up until June 2009, our trustee remuneration policy differentiated between remuneration paid to our independent specialist trustees and remuneration paid to what we called principal trustees. Now, the independent specialist trustees were paid a hourly rate for serving on the board, and our principal trustees received a set meeting fee. Both Mr. Andrew and Mr. Peterson are independent specialist trustee, and therefore we've been paying them an hourly rate. I must also indicate to the honourable members that both Mr. Andrew and Ms. Peterson have been serving on a number of task teams on this board, for which they've also received remuneration. Admiral Becker, for instance, is a principal trustee and has been receiving a set meeting fee. In 2009, the previous board revised the trustee remuneration policy, and all trustees are now receiving a set meeting fee, regardless if they're independent specialists or principal trustees. On the question of the 28 trustees, Rule 4.1.2 of the GEP Law and Rules prescribes that the board is governed by 16 board members. For each board member, we've also got a substitute or alternate trustees. We do remunerate these alternate trustees as well because they are serving on one or two of our board subcommittees.
Before the chair, there's a question that has been posed on the acting principal officer. We have Dr. George will be receiving a written reply to the written question that we have posed to the minister about it. And as far as we are aware, we have not received any legal notice because we believe we have honored the side of our obligation because we are fully paying out for the remainder of the contract. Dadeji.
Just two from my side. I think there was a question asked on the other funds. These are the National Treasury Funds, special pension fund, which is currently administered by GPF. Then we've got two other smaller funds, that is temporary employees pension fund, also on behalf of National Treasury, and associated institution pension fund, also on behalf of National Treasury. Those are the other funds that we are currently managing. The fraud, we do agree. The problem why they take long to resolve is because these are not evident fraud. These are the fraud that we receive tips through the hotline. Sometimes they phone you, they say, go and check pension number, and so something is going to happen. So these are the ones that we distill and we start investigating. So all these allegations, we take them seriously. That's why they take long to finalize. We've got a fraud hotline on which people phone us and assist us on the perceived fraudulent activities around. The last one was the underwriting. What I was saying is that government is the underwriter of the pension scheme. If the scheme falls down and it doesn't have funds, we are going to look at government to make good for the shortfall. That's what I was saying.
Okay, Mr. Mulato, before you round it up, can I just request something that we're supposed to request when you started, to introduce the whole team so that we know exactly who have been part of the presentation, if you don't really mind.
Yes. My apologies for that. We wrote the list to the committee secretary, so I thought that the other members of the team who are not being introduced, on the right of Mr. Chie is the deputy chairperson of the board, Mr. Prabir Badal, and the CFO of the fund is Hanan Sikila, and the head of legal from the fund side is Ms. Jolene Moodley, and the chief operating officer from the administration side is Ms. Manditu Gola. And I no longer call him the young man now because he's engaged. Our head of investment is the John Olifant, a brilliant actuary and head of investment. And the head of legal from the administration side is Ms. S.T. Devet, and this is our acting principal officer, Ms. Van Nickel.
Okay, thank you very much. From the side of Parliament to the Government Employee Pension Fund, we really want to appreciate this input that you made today, the discussions that took place, the clarity on areas that needed to be cleared. I can see the Honourable Member still wants to proceed, but can I request that in the light of the fact that the input and the responses that were made, in our opinion, requires that we need a further interaction. There are areas that we have identified. There are areas that we think we have to proceed to actually engage with GEPF. And our opinion is that we will look into the right time when we will recall the institution to come and do a presentation on areas of collaboration, particularly from public service and administration, together with finance. And therefore, can I request them from the members, due to the time and also the agenda that is actually before us, that we no longer have time on this issue. And my apologies, Honourable Member, I'm sure I'm going to suppress you on this one so that you're able to stick within the time
and we proceed with all other matters for the day. It's not it's not out of respect, but it's because we definitely cannot move beyond where we are at this point in time. I can see the hand is still continuing to be up. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. It is very unusual to not ask the member why his hand is up. But anyway, I just wanted to raise the point that there was a question of mine that was not answered. I will wait for the next interaction on it, but I must say that it is, I don't believe that it's acceptable to try to ignore my my request to speak. Thank you, Chair.
Co-chair, you realize these are members of the Finance Committee. They would have an opportunity to raise those issues elsewhere. It's fine. But to add on what you have said, co-chair here, to the presenters, Government Employee Pension Fund people, that one of the things that we've raised, and I think this is something that you should take with yourself, is your four pillars. And I think Honorable Suka said he would actually withhold most of his questions, particularly around pillar number four. And why I'm picking this issue, in your opening remark, Chairperson, is that you said East Buyer Fund and generally the PIC and the manner in which the investment had been directed in the past was somehow narrowly focused on pillar number four. It will be important for us to know in future how you intend to address that particular aspect. And my assumption is that you'd be moving from a base that says there's no best teacher than experience. Secondly, what is it that we regard as successes and what is it that we regard as failures? And therefore, the methodology that we want to apply to correct this anomaly. You did also indicate that in terms of the resolution that you've taken as a board, a new board, funds more than 5% of the total fund probably in Sibaya, however, as an investment will actually be require the board approval. I think that's one measure that we are beginning to put in place. The second or third issue in your presentation, you speak about shareholder participation. I think it's shareholder activism, basically. And I think it's one area that really needs to be strengthened moving forward on behalf of the pensioners. The one issue that we normally tend to take as one of those referral or issues is the issue of fraud and corruption. You know, hotlines are there. You know, it's like policies. Policies are as good as they are impacting, or they can impact on the lives of people. The case in point of the retired school principal in KZN that you are, you have, and we must commend you for that, that you're addressing the issue. I don't want to know when is he going to get his money, because this individual has got family and relatives and probably even loan sharks. So it is not in the interest of the individual to say when this matter is going to be addressed. But we really appreciate that it's going to be addressed. But to me, it's just a tip of an iceberg. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of these cases, and they don't start now. This, to a certain extent, is going to be addressed, and it will need to be addressed through your platform, turnaround strategy on how you're going to address this issue. This manual thing of filling a form,
retiring goes to the district. The district officer is on leave for 6 weeks. He sits there until he comes back. Then it moves on. It comes back the same way. SARS is a good example. And I think Home Affairs, you know, those of us who have now recently, as ordinary citizens of South Africa, applied for visas or for passports through Home Affairs, you realize that 9 days is possible to get everything done in Home Affairs. And these are the simple stories that we must be able to tell. These are the successes that our government is making. And I think your new modernization plan must have time frames. Don't talk about it. Tell us when it's going to happen. When I speak about your return, IRP forms, the e-files, e-system, they have managed to draw a large number of people within a very short space of time. And I think this turnaround period of paying out people's pensions and the number of days that you have highlighted in your presentation can be actually be done away within a very, very short space of time. There are experiences in other relevant and sister bodies within government that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Go there, share experiences, and see how best you can deal with these issues. The last question that has been raised by Honorable Dreyer is the issue of PESA. It's a cross-cutting issue. It's not just a question of the Department of Public Service and Administration. It's a matter that requires interdepartmental coordination, and the role of Parliament is quite critical in making sure that those issues are addressed. I thought we should just give you this message as you move on, but overall, within a very short space of time, you've managed to come up with your investment developmental plan, which is very, very critical. It is how it is going to be realized. And we'll be very, very, very much interested on how you're going to implement that plan as Parliament. We have concurred with the co-chair here that we'll take a break for 5 minutes and come back to take the remaining presentations. Thank you very much.
Of our agenda item for today, as you know, that we also invited GEMS, Government Employment Medical Scheme, that is going to present today. So I'll just get an indication if GEMS is ready, but we will have an introductory part done by the department. In order to clear that there is no confusion, I know that Lavin had been the DG for Public Safety and Administration. He is not here in that capacity at this point in time, Richard Lovett. He is here as a chairperson of GEMS, so that we are not really confused, and he will therefore handle it at that level. At this point in time, I am going to hand over to the acting DG, Colette Luck, to actually do the introduction, and thereafter we'll have GEMS then proceeding.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Good morning to you, Honourable Members. I have been requested just to indicate our relationship, with GEMS before GEMS gives you feedback in relation to their performance. Just to give you the historical background, Cabinet had approved the notion of a government employee's medical aid scheme in 2004. The Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Chamber in 2006 had to then engage with all public sector members, public service members, around the notion of a closed and a restricted medical aid scheme, which they then approved because of the subsidy portion that goes to public servants. That was Resolution 1 of 2006. GEMS was born out of that particular resolution. Hence, you will not see GEMS in the Public Service Act, neither will you see it in the Public Service Regulations. It only got its life from a collective agreement because year on year, part of the collective bargaining process, the issues of the subsidies for members then is negotiated, because that impacts on the functionality of GEMS. The shareholders are all the members that belong to the medical aid. So there is a difference as to who the shareholder is in this particular instance. The other issue is that the relationship between the Minister for Public Service and Administration and GEMS is that he appoints 6 employer representatives to the board of GEMS, and therefore his relationship is through those 6 employer representatives. With regard to the DPSA works very closely with GEMS insofar as we deal with the issue of the appropriate subsidy to members, because that comes out of the fiscus, and therefore we need to understand that particular relationship between ourselves and the money from the state. So it's not unique that an employer has a restricted or a closed fund, as what you will, a medical aid scheme, as you will then have in the private sector. So that just gives you some background. In terms of our original relationship, there was an initial cash injection as seed funding to GEMS from the state's fiscus. That was in 2004-2005 and 2000-2006. That was the last cash injection, which was for capital in terms of starting off the fund. Going forward, I think the GEMS chairperson and the principal officer will give you an indication of what is the arrangement after that particular injection. So that is giving you a background in terms of the relationship between ourselves as the DPSA as well as GEMS as a medical aid scheme that falls under the Medical Aid Act. And it is not in terms of the Public Service Act. The Medical Aid Act is administered by the Minister of Health, and they have a Council for Medical Aid Schemes that oversees the governance arrangements of all medical aid schemes. So the corporate form for GEMS is a medical aid scheme. So it's not the other corporate forms that you will then find in the Public Service Act. So there is a difference in terms of the governance arrangements between the medical aid scheme and that of the Council for Medical Aid Schemes that oversees the governance arrangements. I think with that background, that clears the aspect in terms of our relationship. Thanks.
Okay, maybe let me just interject there and request you to further clarify the relationship the same way as you did with GEPF, because we also invited them quite jointly. So it's important for that clarity to also surface. We then will move on to the presentation by Jim.
Yes, very similarly with the GEPF, it's also through the subsidy arrangements. Each public servant gets a subsidy portion to their contribution to the GEPF, and the GEPF is administered by the Minister of Finance under the GEPF Act, and there are pension laws that are subsidiary to the GEPF Act. There are a number of employer representatives that also serve on the board of the GEPF fund as well. Similarly, as you have a number of members serving on the GEMS board. So the relationships are extremely similar. I think the only difference here is, the aspect of the governance arrangements in relation to the Minister of Finance, which it is directly under him in relation to that act. So in terms of the aspect of that, because with the GEMS, our minister is not administering the act for GEMS, the Medical Aid Act. It's been administered by the Minister of Finance, of Health in that particular instance. So that is the difference in relation to the reporting lines.
Mr. Lavi.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And honourable members, thank you very much for this opportunity to table a presentation on the Government Employees Medical Scheme. Thank you for clarifying my position. I serve on the Board of GEMS at the pleasure of the Minister for Public Service and Administration and Cabinet. I serve as Chairperson of the Scheme at the pleasure of the Board of Trustees and membership of the Scheme. I still have 1 year left in terms of my appointment to the board, but after each AGM, the board takes a decision about the chairpersonship and deputy chairpersonship of the Board of Trustees. So that is why I'm here. Notwithstanding my transfer to the Department of Economic Development, I'm joined on my left by the Principal Officer of GEMS, Dr. Eugene Watson, and we have also with us two senior managers, David Machabo, who deals with stakeholder relations, and Damaria Polosa, who deals with risk management. So that is our team. I will be dealing with the overview, in a sense, the brief appraisal of the scheme's background, and then the principal officer will take over the bulk of the presentation, which deals with the performance in 2009 and an update of performance in 2010. I think as the acting DG of the DPSA has indicated, in 2004, Cabinet provided an overarching mandate whereby the state as employer seeks to ensure that there's an adequate provisioning of healthcare coverage to public service employees that is efficient, cost-effective, and equitable, and to provide further options for those who wish to purchase more extensive cover. I think really this mandate was informed by entrenched inequity, high costs, absent employer control or influence, and limited access to scheme benefits by all employees. Now, of course, I think as the acting DG has pointed out, having a restricted medical scheme is not unique at all. Many large private sector employers have restricted schemes for their employees. And given the size of the public service, the state has a single larger employer, a decision was taken that there should be some form of intervention in an industry which I think is quite a contested industry, and an industry which has in many instances actually driven up the costs of healthcare. And I think this was one of the key drivers of the decision by Cabinet to move into this particular area. The acting DG did talk to some of the policy steps. Actually, in 2000 already, PSCVC Resolution 7 provided for the restructuring of medical assistance, and work began. And I think you can see that over quite a long period, some very serious work was undertaken, with the major feasibility studying being in 2004, leading to Cabinet approval of the registration of GEMS, which took place in 2005, with enrollment commencing in 2006. There were obviously skeptics all around, but currently we have over 450,000 members, and I believe that the numbers and the financials that we will present today will assure you that the decision that was taken was a correct decision, and also provide some confidence that actually government can get some things right. As the acting DG indicated, the medical subsidy policy was agreed and introduced in July 2006, which made some adjustments in order to establish GEMS as the preferred medical scheme for public service employees. And the President's Coordinating Council resolved that executing authorities and HRODs should promote employee awareness of the subsidy policy. As indicated, GEMS is a restricted membership medical scheme. It's fully registered under the Medical Schemes Act. It reports to the Registrar of Medical Schemes. It subscribes to the Medical Schemes Act 131 of 1998, and the establishment is provided for in Resolution Number 1 of 2006. Member eligibility is limited to national and provincial departments and administrations listed in Schedule 1 and 2 of the Public Service Act, as well as organizational components listed in Schedule 3 of the Public Service Act, and then approved employer groups or related government structures which apply to the scheme, and in consultation with the Registrar, decisions are taken by the Board of Trustees with regards to those applications. But it's important to note that the Defense Force, NIA, and SAS have conditions of service which do not allow for enrollment in GEMS. In terms of the corporate structure, the Board of Trustees comprises of 50% elected by members and 50% appointed by the Minister for the Public Service and Administration in consultation with Cabinet, and this is the governing structure of the scheme. The principal officer implements the directives of the board and manages the business, and the scheme executive supports the principal officer in monitoring and managing the service levels and contractual obligations of appointed service providers. We have a highly efficient scheme head office of 28 team members, whereby strategic and risk management are owned and managed internally. We have adopted a multiple administrator model where operational activities are outsourced. These would deal with managed care, with scheme administration itself, the medicine clearinghouse, and emergency medical service, amongst others. And the resources are dedicated to ensuring effective member services, and the performance of the scheme is constantly monitored, both by the principal officer and his team, as well as by the Board of Trustees. But I think the key point that we want to make is that the locus of control always rests within the scheme, notwithstanding the particular business model that we have adopted. Very briefly, our mission statement is to provide all public service employees with equitable access to affordable and comprehensive healthcare benefits. Our vision, an excellent, sustainable, and effective medical scheme for all public service employees. And our value statement includes the values of excellence, member orientation, flexibility, value for money, simplicity, consistent application, innovation, prudence, clear communication, responsiveness, and integrity. I'm going to hand over to the principal officer, but there is information on the presentation on our member services, should the honourable members want to do some tests for themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the committee. I think just continuing with the presentation, the first part will focus on the performance in 09. Our financial year is that of a calendar year, so it's for the year ended 31 December 2009. If we look at the table, I have some of the key features of our 2009 performance. It shows the statistics by each of the five benefit options members can join. I will focus on the total column, which is on your right-hand side. The net contributions per member in the year of 2009 was 1,752. The net contributions per life or per beneficiary per month was 732 rand. Our non-healthcare expenses, the cost of operating the business of GEMS, was 7% of contribution income, which is less than a third of what the market average is at the moment. The number of new members who joined GEMS in the year was 129,000, primarily on our Emerald option, and 17,000 members left the scheme. What is interesting when you look at that 17,000 is since inception, 50,000 members have resigned from GEMS. But we've received over 500,000 applications, which means our attrition rate over 4.5 years is 10%. Per year is less than 3%, which is about a third of what the attrition rate is in the public service at the moment, per year. Our pensioner ratio is 4.13%. This affects the performance of all medical schemes. Your older, sicker members tend to claim more, and this has an adverse effect on the scheme. Our pensioner members have primarily selected our top option, which is the Onyx option, where you can see that 20.4% of members on that option are in fact pensioners. Our average accumulated funds per member, or the integrity of our balance sheet, is 2,407 rand. We've heard that the mandate revolves around equity, access, and affordability, and this chart shows you quite nicely our membership in 2009. And it confirms that 30% of our members earned less than 6,000 rand per month. It's a little lower than it was in 2008, and this is due to the salary increases, OSDs, and wage adjustments in 2009, specifically around July. But it is good to know that almost a third of our members earn less than 6,000 rand. If we look at our balance sheet for the year, these come from our audited financials. We finalized our submission to the council. I just didn't have copies of the printed booklet with us for this meeting, but I will circulate them to the committee through the chair. We held cash and cash equivalents of 1.6 billion rand at the end of 2009. Our total assets exceeded 1.7 billion rand, which is 500 million rand more than it was in 2008. Our accumulated funds, the reserve, is 986 million rand at the end of the year, and we carry a provision for claims incurred but not received yet of 317 million rand on our balance sheet. If we look at our income statement, we collected premiums or contribution income of 8.7 billion rand in the year of 2009, which is over 3 billion rand more than in the year before. We paid claims of 7.9 billion rand, and our total surplus for the year was 263 million. If we look at the achievements in 2009, it was quite a difficult year for the scheme, but we did have a number of achievements. We continued our rapid growth in members to over 429,000. We introduced a number of innovative services, two in particular, the SMS benefit check. This is a real-time service where members can SMS the scheme before they incur costs, before they see a doctor, before they get their medicine, and at a real-time level get an alert of what benefits they have available. So before they incur the cost, they know what the implications are for them. We also introduced a maternity program because maternity and pregnancy-related issues are amongst our most common reasons for admission to hospital. More than 60% of our members are female, primarily from the education and healthcare sectors, and this program helps both mother and child at the time of the birth. We have over 10,000 healthcare providers registered on Friends of Gems. This is an SMS service. These are providers who have agreed to see our members at the rates we pay. So there's no co-pay, no levy, no surcharge for the members. So this is advantageous to the member because essentially those 10,000 providers have or deliver wallet-free service. The member doesn't need to take their purse with them. We run an independent member satisfaction survey annually, and the 2009 survey revealed that over 75% of our members had a positive perception of GEMS. In fact, more than 54% were delighted with the experience on the scheme. We hosted our second annual symposium in KZN in the third quarter of last year, which was well attended, and we discussed topical matters related to employee health and wellness and HR practitioners. Complaints from members and service providers are monitored closely. They remained low despite the continued growth of the scheme through the year. An annual board effectiveness appraisal was performed by an auditor and was found to be good. We held a successful AGM on the 30th of June. It was the highest attendance we've ever had for an AGM. All our resolutions were passed. We continue to maintain our record of posting surpluses since inception, and our audit environment is well maintained. In fact, during 2009, we had over 14 different audits taking place, besides the statutory audit which is required. Our fourth annual audit opinion is an unqualified one. SLAs were maintained throughout the year, service level, and these were confirmed by an independent audit of our service level agreements and performance against those levels. The business of MedCorp, which is the closed medical scheme for correctional services, was transferred to GEMS on the 31st of December 2009. Effectively on the 1st of January this year, MedCorp ceased to exist as a medical scheme. Our fraud prevention plan has been implemented. We have six cases which have already gone as far as the courts, and we are supported by the SIU in this process. We did have a few challenges in 2009. I think some of the key challenges, the main one is that claims were higher than anticipated. Like every medical scheme, in the second quarter of the year before, you plan your financial performance for that year, you predict what claims would be, and then you cost your contribution. 2009 was tough. We had numerous epidemics. In the first quarter of the year, we had an epidemic of a virus which caused lots of little children to have gastroenteritis and pneumonia. We had the swine flu outbreak. We also had an outbreak of flu in the latter part of the third quarter of last year. Statutory tariffs, these are the rates which are charged for medicine and doctors, the reference price list and the single exit price. These were increased and introduced for 2009 in 2009 after GEMS and every other medical scheme had projected its costs for the year. The Onyx option posted a loss.
this is quite, I think this is something we take quite seriously, but it is pleasing that one of our five options made a loss, while the market average is 63% of all benefit options make losses. So we certainly are doing better than the market, and we know this is because we have 20% of the members being pensioners. Our reserves at the end of 2009 was 11.08%, which is lower than the 11.93 target we had, which was set by the Council for Medical Schemes for new medical schemes. We have an incremental phased approach to the building up of reserves. Cost of living increases, OSDs, and adjustments to salary levels were introduced in 1 July. This posed a significant problem for GEMS. Our contribution table is based on income. So for each option, depending on what you earn, you will pay a certain amount of money. The lower earner essentially gets the same benefit for less money than the higher earner. It's one of the measures we've introduced to promote access. Because of these salary changes, all combined into 1 year, many people moved up a level. So what you had was a member perceived GEMS to be charging more, when in fact we charged the same. Because they earned more, they needed to pay more. The difficulty was that some of these salary changes were backdated well into 2007. And our debt management processes kick in and we start to collect the monies which are due from the employer and the member. There was a significant amount of dissatisfaction. We had predicted there would be a higher cost of living adjustment, and we had increased the bands accordingly, but we certainly hadn't anticipated the impact of the OSDs. This is something we are preparing for now. We are adjusting our income bands to accommodate all of these and potential future changes so that we don't have a repeat of this in future years. We are assisting the Department of International Relations and Cooperation with employees who are stationed abroad. At the moment, employees are covered either by themselves, by the department, or their medical scheme. To provide some consistency, we are looking at developing an international option. So when employees who are members of GEMS travel are stationed abroad, we would fund the international claims through this benefit option. It makes it easier for the department because they would then just continue paying a normal contribution rather than actually administering claims. The obtaining of data from the department was slower than we had anticipated last year, but this work has kicked off quite rapidly in the first quarter of this year. The council instructed GEMS to amend its member eligibility rule to remove the application of discretion. The council didn't like us when a government-related entity, like themselves, in fact, like a council, wanted to also join GEMS. We would assess who they are, what their conditions of service are, what the demographic of the employees is, and then the board would decide to permit them or not. And the council said, no, it's not fair that you're allowed to assess. You should just take who you consider to be eligible. So we are in discussion with the council on this rule in particular. In summary, when looking at 2009, significant progress was made by the scheme. A strategic shift in healthcare management took place. 96% of the indicators in our strategic plan for the year were met. This is the strategic plan we shared with the Public Service Portfolio Committee at our previous meeting. And all our indicators in the three-year plan were attended to successfully. A further level of achievement was also evident when reviewing the progress. We did not receive a qualified audit. We didn't experience a cash crisis. We didn't experience a service catastrophe, and the scheme was not brought into disrepute through the course of 2009. Members of the committee, if I now move on to the final section, which is relatively short. Looking at 2010, the chairperson has spoken to our strategic principles. Our plan for the year is informed by performance in 2009, the successes and the challenges we faced. Consideration of strategic matters that require attention, and an appreciation of the capacity and the resources we have available to do the required and approved work. Our theme for the year is sustaining excellence by reviewing the effectiveness of GEMS, the business, incorporating efficiencies, and providing an enabling environment for future success. We've initiated a number of strategies over the last 4 years, and we need to implement these all and apply the results of those strategies and assess them too. There's a need for us to take stock. The scheme has grown rapidly, and it is actually quite a sophisticated business. If a third of our members earn less than 6,000 Rand, we need to be sure that all the technology we have available actually is useful and is appreciated by those members. Otherwise, there's no point in having a highly sophisticated service our members don't make use of. This is a prudent approach as well, because sustaining the excellence of GEMS is important, especially in this environment that is characterized by extensive change. If we look at this dashboard chart, which we use all the time in board meetings as well as in presentations to the minister and the deputy minister, the blue line indicates our growth in membership since inception, January 2006. The red line plots the ratio of complaints to membership. Essentially, it's a measure of dissatisfaction. And what you can see in the latter part, if you look on the right-hand side of the chart, through 2009 and 10, complaints to membership has remained below 0.1%. That means in any given month, less than 1 in 10,000 of our members have complained about a service, despite the fact that when you look at the blue line, we've continued to grow. As of yesterday, we had more than 469,000 members on the scheme and 1.310 million beneficiaries. So when you look at this, despite the growth, dissatisfaction is contained. It implies that satisfaction is under control at the moment. If you look at our membership and where they come from and whether we're fulfilling the mandate which the acting DG of DPSA and the chairperson have introduced, the chart shows you each province and it shows you our penetration of eligible employees in that province. The blue line shows you the statistic as at December 2007, is there to give you a comparison, and the red shows you the figure as of March 2010. If you look across at the 50% mark, you will see in more than four provinces, we now cover more than half of their public service employees. The Western Cape, the Northern Cape, the Northwest, and the Free State. It's pleasing to note that there are four provinces where we are also almost at 40%, the Eastern Cape, KZN, Limpopo, and Mpumalanga. What is very pleasing is the rapid growth, the penetration we've had in the Eastern Cape over the last 2 years. This initially at a marketing level was a very difficult province to penetrate, but we're actually reaping the rewards of those efforts. If you look across the public service, just again in terms of the mandate, this chart really deals with Purcell data we have available, which we have looked at. The top table on the slide shows you the number of public service employees in February 2006 when the scheme started, and December 2009. Essentially, the public service or the Purcell employees has grown by 180,000 in that space of 4 years. 52% of all Purcell employees reflected on Purcell were covered by a medical scheme in 2006, and it's gone up to 54%. 151,000, however, of those employees are salary level 17 employees. They are the sessional workers and the contract workers, and they are not all eligible for a subsidy. 20,000 employees within those figures are actually dependents on GEMS. So there's husband and wife, and they are on, and only one is counted when you look at the coverage. But what is very pleasing is when you look at this number, there are 821,178 employees who have been employed in the public service all the while. So they were there in 2006 and they have remained. So that's the base where you can look to see what we have achieved. At the time of 2006, 371,000 of those employees were not covered. That has reduced now to 287,000 by 22%. 172,000 employees terminated their service in those 4 years, and 362,000 new employees were appointed. The assertion is often made that GEMS grows because of it's compulsory for new employees. But when you look at the new employees, 29% are members of GEMS versus an average in the public service of 38%. So the bulk of our members are in fact existing public servants and not primarily the new employees. If we look at the level 1 to 5 employees at the bottom of the slide, you will see that over the 4 years, the coverage of these employees has increased from 41% to just under 50%. And that I think is a 10% movement, which is significant when looking at the numbers. At an activity level, to give you an idea, Chairperson, of the size of the scheme now, we are much smaller than the institution that sat here earlier this morning. We can't say we deal with a third of GDP.
But we are pleased that from inception until now, we have actually grown quite significantly. Our average age, family size, and pensioner ratio is better than the medical scheme industries. We handled 263,000 calls in the month of March, 19,000 emails, and processed 12,000 applications. We paid 5.6 million claim lines in the month of March alone. We collected over R1 billion in contributions for the month, which means our contribution income for this year will exceed 12 billion. We carry the provision on our balance sheet for claims incurred, not received, of 526 million rand, and our reserves in the first quarter is 895 million. It's a little lower than December last year, which is normal for medical scheme because in the first quarter you have a new year with new benefits and members do their eyes, their teeth, and go to the GP. So later on in the year, we will see the accumulated funds increase seasonally as expected. But cash at the end of the period was 2 billion rand. We are working on our quarter two deliverables for our strategic plan. We are implementing an approach to member consumerism, which is something we are quite excited with and excited about. It is important for members of medical schemes to be informed consumers. You can't get dissatisfied with your doctor or your medical scheme when services are not paid for. The member should know their rights and entitlements beforehand and also what their duties are. So this is a campaign we are running with, and we will see how it flows over the next few years. We're confirming GEMS eligibility rules. We are monitoring the implementation of the NHI. The chairperson and the acting DG have mentioned the changes to our board. In terms of our rules, trustees serve for terms of office of 3 years. So we're running a member election process at the moment for 3 trustees whose term ends in July, and the minister has been requested to appoint employer representatives to the board because of the terms of office ending. We are managing the scheme's performance quite closely. We monitor claims experience against the projection. Our first quarter of 2010 in nominal terms was better than the first quarter in 2009. We have already commenced our 2010 audit cycle, and we continue to participate in CMS or Council for Medical Scheme task teams and ministerial activities. In conclusion, members of the committee, the business is operating well. Growth is significant. Work is centered on executing the strategic plan. Risks have been identified and are being mitigated. Controls are established and well implemented. In a press release on Sunday night, the Council for Medical Schemes is celebrating its 10th year of existence. And it counts, so it says it smiles at a number of its achievements. And one of the achievements is, in fact, the registration of GEMS. Because in the 4 years the scheme has been around, because more than 55% of our members did not use the subsidy before, we've brought in 1 million lives. And the total medical scheme pool has increased by 1 million people in the last 4 years. It is proposed that the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration and that of the Finance note this update on GEMS and its performance in the previous year. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Honorable members, we are going to take questions in the light of also a tight time. I know that members must also eat before they go to the next business for the day. Can I see how many hands do we have? Okay. Honorable Dreyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. The slide 2009 business indicators, just from, as a matter of interest, you explained to us the total scheme, the pensioner ratio very high and the only option, they're very concentrated there. Then the number of new members, most of them went to the Emerald option. And then the number of members leaving, they come from a different option. That's the better option. What is the socioeconomic or the demographics behind that? It's just an interesting sociological observation, or that would be an interesting clarification from you. Then the second question is challenges for 2009, the last bullet point there. You've been instructed to amend your member eligibility rules to remove the application of discretion by the board. Now, you used to kind of get applications and then the board would evaluate them. What basis, what was the basis of that evaluation? What objectives did you use to decide yes or no to accept a member?
Thank you, Honorable Treya. I think that was the only question. Oh, there are two hands, Honorable Bigani and Honorable Suka. Any other hand? Okay, I will take you in that order, starting with Honorable Bigani.
Chair, in terms of the threat chain, apparently there's progress that has been made, but it doesn't really talk to us. There's nothing being said to us in terms of what's in the document here for us to can determine. I mean, for how long have you been in existence for us not to be having a threat plan? Because we need to know where you come from and where you are presently and what is the way forward. And just a question here. I'm interested in knowing, in terms of work underway, maybe I'm a bit behind with information, but there's something about monitoring the implementation of the NHI. Can you give more details about that? Because I would have thought that processes are not yet that far for them to already be monitoring implementation thereof. Perhaps there's a gap of information that I have. And then, once again, on one of the slides there, I don't know, there's no page on the 2010 strategic plan. There's something where they say initiated strategies must be implemented and practically applied. And there's something that says there is a need to take stock and appraise where GEMS is so as to effectively plan the next 3-year strategy. It sounds like to me working back to front in terms of those statements, because if there's no straight plan, how are you then able to work all these years and be able to give financial statements and so on, and yet you still feel that there's something about taking stock there? Maybe there's something I don't understand for your straight plan. It almost gives me a picture as though you don't have a straight plan, if I'm understanding that correctly. And you know, the way the presentation is put, you're just generalizing in terms of what is happening within GEMS. It would have been nicer to actually see also your challenges. You know, perhaps I should just say a detailed threat plan would basically have answered us more effectively than what we have in front of us. Thank you, Chair.
Suka?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's a pity that the enemy is time during this time. So I can't move as I would wish to. But let us ask us very simple questions without going to the core. They are saying that the GEM is growing. And when you measure that up with their complaints, it's they remain low. When you speak of low, in terms of percentage, in terms of those complaints, can you translate that into a percentage to understand at least your complaints? What percentage do you receive the annum and so on, so that we can check, you can balance that up with the growth? Because also you do have resignations. Fortunately, you did illustrate that 50,000 visa the intake and so on. The question of the OSD. Can you give me a little bit of explanation around that? You say cost of living increase, numerous OSDs and adjustments to salary levels were introduced effectively. Were you also directly affected, and in what way around this issue of OSD? Otherwise, let us stop there. Otherwise, I do have some questions more than the document.
Okay, I think I will...
executive.
All right. I'll come to that issue at the end, Honorable Suga. On the issues of the questions that you still have. Okay, responses?
Thanks, Chairperson. I'll just briefly respond to assure the members that we have a strategic plan. We're currently finalizing our annual report for 2009, but we can give the previous years in the meantime. As soon as our 2009 report, which is being prepared for the AGM to be held at the end of May, is complete, then we will provide the members with that as well, which will give a clear indication of the strategic plan and its implementation. On the national health insurance, what it means is that as the Department of Health moves forward with this initiative, there is interaction because obviously it is a policy decision which has been taken by the ruling party and it will impact on GEMS, so we need to be engaging on an ongoing basis and take decisions in relation to that progress. So that's all we're talking about, is as the policy is developed, as it gets taken as well through the parliamentary processes, we will be engaging as a medical scheme, the second largest medical scheme actually in the country. I'll ask the principal officer to deal with the other questions.
Thanks, Chairperson. If we start from the top, the demographic changes, I think your older, sicker members typically look for the benefit which covers them the most, which is why we have a high number of pensioners on Onyx. The percentage isn't representative of the total number of GEMS members because there aren't many members on the Onyx option. It's our third largest benefit option. The Emerald options are most popular, both in terms of what it offers for younger families as well as in terms of its pricing. And the Beryl option typically loses members at the beginning of each year, and it's because members don't like the way of the benefits available and where they get them from. And the Beryl option works in terms of networks. You can't access any provider. You access a provider in a network. So some members typically prefer having the freedom of choice in terms of where they go, and the members exercise their right to pay more for that choice. In terms of the Council for Medical Schemes and our rules, we will simply evaluate participating employers on the basis of their risk to the scheme. I think Section 57 of the Medical Schemes Act says we must always act in the best interest of the scheme. So we look at the financial impact, the clinical impact, the operational impact. In so doing, we will review the employer group for the number of employees they have, the number of pensioners they have, any subsidy arrangements they may have, and then look at how those people would behave if they were on GEMS. Because if it was a negative impact, you'd have to be informed of that before you agreed to take this group on, because it affects the overall well-being of the scheme. In terms of the question on the initiated strategies and the taking stock, I think it may just be the terminology in the slide that I used. The strategies, they are not the strategic plan. We do have an annual strategic plan, which the chair has mentioned. Our 09 plan was shared with the committee. We will submit the detailed progress report against that plan, so you can see the 96% we're speaking about in terms of the previous year, and we'll share the 2010 with the committee too. What I was talking about is the smaller plan. So we have a translation plan. We have a plan that over the next 3 years we will translate all GEMS information into all official languages, starting in the first year with newsletters and annual reports, moving on to letters and system-generated information, and also with the call center. So it's just to see that mature. That runs through more than a financial year because it's staggered over many years. And then the taking stock is really, as I had mentioned, we have many services available. It's complicated. We have benefit options, income bands. We have SMS services, web services, call center services. We have a specific pre-authorization service where you never speak to a person. You deal with the telephone and push numbers. These are great services. They may be great even in this forum, but to our average member who works in a worm's plate, who drives around in a car, it's just impossible. He actually would prefer seeing somebody face-to-face. So we need to just look at that. It's no use we have the Rolls-Royce of features, and they don't use them. It matters that they use the services. The section on complaints, I think we do monitor them. We take the actual number of complaints, whether they are valid or invalid. So that chart isn't us stripping out what we deem to be a true complaint or just somebody who's upset that we are right. We then also look at it as a percentage because you should adjust. In real terms, you're looking at about 350 complaints a month of any variety on a base of 1.3 million people and 6 million claims. So we don't want to look at it like that because the temptation is then to say, this is much smaller than the number of people, so let's not take it seriously. To avoid that, we convert it to a percent and say, let's act on how this percentage moves. Any increase, regardless of whether it's 10 complaints, requires attention. We should find the causal factors. And we have a detailed report which shows the breakdown of these complaints, The board sees that quarterly, and then we report on what we've done. And in terms of the OSBs, I think just to recap, if you join GEMS, let's take one option. A teacher joins GEMS Emerald option. Based on what they earn, they will pay a certain amount of money. We have income bands, people who earn between 0 and 5,000, 5,000 to 8,000, 8,000 above, pay a different amount. So let's assume this teacher was in the middle. She earned between 5 to 8,000 rand. The OSD was introduced effective 1 July. But the money was only paid in October. So on the payroll from 1 July, we are told that she actually earned 8,000. So our normal debt management kicks in to say, well, personnel or payroll, you need to pay us this increased contribution for July, August, September, October. And that's where the backlog comes in. So the members see it as GEMS is taking more, but it's the same pricing, it's just they are eligible to pay more. We're actually trying to change our rules because we just can't deal with this. So we're trying to change our rules to say, from the month the money arrives, we will start to charge you more. So we don't have to get caught up in the backdating, because some of the OSDs which were implemented at the end of last year in December actually go back quite a long time and involve the educators, which is a big percentage of our membership. So that really is the challenge. It's not something we did wrong or failure on our part, but it's a consequence of the change, which we now have to deal with. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you. Maybe it signifies that we are just lapsing time. Honorable Wigan.
We just have a small area of interest where you have a situation where the members are paying to GEMS their dues, but you're still faced with a situation where when you go to a pharmacist, for example, you always have this thing of a levy. How does GEMS ensure that that is actually dealt with, or to a minimal, if possible, if I can put it that way?
Thank you. A very quick one. We think those co-pays and levies are the enemy. So we put in place contracts at different levels to avoid them. We have contracts with the hospital, so they will never charge the levies. We have contracts with a chronic designated service provider, a pharmacy who delivers our members chronic medicine. The members don't have co-pays and levies. And we try to, with the SMS checks, also advise the member beforehand whether there will be one or not. But between the contracts we have and the Friends of GEMS service, where we say these 10,000 providers will see you without that levy, we encourage members to use that service. So those are some of them.
Okay, before I hand over to my co-chair to close this meeting, there are just few things that I need to indicate. The first one being that we are not going to get to the administrative issues because it's a joint committee, and therefore the administration will focus on only one, which therefore means they fall off, the admin falls off. The other issue is that as the Public Safety and Administration Committee, we have came to the last interaction with the stakeholders. We've been involved in that process. The ones that you met today were the very last ones. What we're going to do, especially in the light of also what Honorable Suka did raise, we might have not exhausted a number of other things, which we want to utilize that space and time to give a brief to the department so that they get the responses. Because the next meeting that is coming on the 12th, it will be, while we'll be getting the briefing by the Public Service and Administration on signatures of a performance agreement on heads of departments, we'll also be getting the Department of Public Safety and Administration's issue on the risk management as the outcome of the audit report, and also on the human resource plan. Coupled with that, maybe the starting point would be summarized version of the stakeholders of Public Safety and Administration as we've interacted and the issues that were raised, particularly those that we had issues that had to be cleared. So I'm going to start with those. I know among them, CETA being one of the issues that had some key issues that came from the Auditor General. And then thereafter, the other meeting would be the last meeting where other institutions are going to be called on this matter. So all the issues, let's get an opportunity that last as a meeting to actually send them so that when they come to the next meeting and give us a summarized approach, they touch on issues that we couldn't really exhaust in this meeting. I am handing over to the co-chair, and thank you.
I won't say much. I think you summarized the meeting, Chairperson. But just to say also, you know this, and I must first really thank you for initiating this joint sitting. It's very clear that when we work together, there is more that we benefit from each other and from one another. There's diverse input that come from various committee members. The enemy's time, as you have said, Honorable Cooper, the enemy's time. I think as we move on, we'll find a better way to manage that aspect. The presentation, there's still a lot that we could engage with or on, but we think it is sufficient for what we have for now. With time, we'll be able to see what else can we put together to make sure that we strengthen that which Honorable Faith has just raised in terms of, you know, these levies that people have to pay. And your machinery, the responses through these gadgets that you put on the other side of the phone, ordinary members and people, you know, they can't relate to those things. It's a first world facility. We need it because we are operating at a different level as South Africa. But we need also to relate with the bottom. You know, we must learn to be at the top and the bottom at the same time. Thank you.
Many things, Ajahn. Thank you very much.